We're going to call a meeting to order the first meeting of the Data Practices Subcommittee for this session. Representative Holberg is here as an ex officio member, not a voting member. We're going to have an overview of the Data Practices Act today from the Department of Administration, but before we do so, we're going to take testimony on the bills that are before us. And why don't we start with House File 672. And we don't have a quorum yet.
Can I make the motion without the quorum?
Yeah, you can make the motion.
All right. But I understand I can still make the motion to recommendation to pass this House File 672 with a recommendation to re-refer the bill to the Commerce Committee. Is that right, Representative Holberg?
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding that Chair Wilkins wants to see this bill.
All right. So that's the motion that the recommendation to the Civil Law Committee, and I understand... That it be passed to the Civil Law Committee for its meeting this afternoon with a recommendation that it be re-referred to the Commerce Committee. Please. And I see we now have a quorum. So you want to start with a testimony?
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members. This bill seeks to remedy a problem that we created last session, and that you'll see the bill before you. We had put in language there was a new division of insurance fraud prevention created, and so we specifically gave them the authority to access specific data as a law enforcement function, and by naming out the name of the insurance fraud prevention in the Department of Commerce, we then took away the authority of other departments within the Department of Commerce that also did investigations such as background checks, et cetera, for realtors' licenses. And so I have a representative here from the Department of Commerce that will explain the problem, and look forward to the support of the committee in fixing the problem that we created last year.
Thank you. If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chair, my name is Gary Lavasser. It's L-A-V-A-S-S-E-U-R. I'm the Enforcement Director for the Department of Commerce. And this morning, the legislation in front of you corrects just what I would call just a mistake last year. The Commerce Department wears two different hats. They're both a regulatory agency. They also engage in law enforcement activity. And since the early 80s, the Commerce Department's been recognized in its law enforcement capacity under this provision of Chapter 13, which allows us to share data with other law enforcement agencies and exchange data. And when the provision was amended, the term Commerce Department was stricken, and substituted in place was the Division of Insurance Fraud. What happened is we then subsequently got involved in other types of criminal investigations, and were in a situation where we couldn't exchange information with other law enforcement agencies. When I said we do other criminal investigations, we do securities fraud investigations, we do real estate fraud investigations, business opportunity, and et cetera. So it's an important piece of legislation, and we'd appreciate your passing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lavasser. Anyone have any questions for Representative Holberg or Mr. Lavasser?
Mr. Chair, given that there are problems right now with this department functioning because of the language that's in current statute, that is why we're requesting that it not be held over for the Omnibus Data Practices Bill, but rather be moved separately so that it can take effect the day following enactment to get the situation resolved as soon as possible.
Thank you. Is there anyone else present that would like to testify on House File 225? Seeing no one, there are no questions, I would renew my motion to recommend to the Civil Law Committee that this House File 225 be re-referred to the Department of Commerce.
Mr. Chair, we're actually considering 672 right now.
Did I say 225? I also said the Department of Commerce, so why don't I correct the whole thing? The motion is a recommendation to the Civil Law Committee to refer
672.
Thank you. 672, we refer it to the Commerce Committee. All those in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. The next bill that I have in front of the subcommittee is House File 225. It's my understanding that this will be the base bill for the House Omnibus Data Practices Bill, and I would assume that you're going to consider it and lay it on the table for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Data Practices Bill.
And I would make that motion right now.
All right, thank you.
Please continue.
With me today is Katie Engler, who works with the Information Policy Analysis Division under Department of Administration, and who has helped prepare this bill. This is purely technical in nature. Generally, over the interim, the department receives requests for temporary data classifications. They run into problems or challenges in working with the law as it stands, and there's a provision whereby the department can provide a temporary classification for data, and then generally we fix those the next legislative session. I think since I've been here, this is the first year that we haven't had temporary classification requests. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Maybe people have just given up on the whole issue. But so instead of that being the base bill, what you have in front of you today is just some technical corrections, and Ms. Engler will explain those to the committee.
Thank you. Ms. Engler?
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, Katie Engler with the Department of Administration. As Representative Holberg has indicated, House File 225 is a technical bill. The first 28 sections all do the same thing, which is when the Data Practices Act began, there were references to state agencies, political subdivisions, and statewide systems. Well, several years ago, the legislature created a term called government entities that is defined to include state agencies, political subdivisions, and statewide systems. So the first 28 sections are changing those two phrases, one for the other. So in every place that the term state agency, statewide system, and political subdivision occur, it is being substituted with the term government entity. Section 29 involves the repealer that appears at the end of the bill. Right now in section 13.04, which is the section on the rights of individuals, there is a subdivision about education records for children with disabilities. What section 29 does is take verbatim the language from section 13.04 subdivision 5 and place it in section 13.32, which is the education data provision, thereby gathering all the education data provisions together. And the final change in the bill, section 30 begins on page 18, line 14. This is a change in the law enforcement data section. If you look on line 20, there is a strikeout for the word confidential and the substitution of the word not or the phrase not public. The reason for this is to direct to law enforcement that they are to separate all not public data from public data before data are released. Not public is also a defined term, and it's broader than the term confidential. And so with that, Mr. Chair and members, that is the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Engler. Representative Holberg, anything more?
I have nothing to add. We'll just answer questions if it's the Chair's desire.
Any questions? Is there anyone else present that would like to testify either for or against this proposed House File 225? Seeing none, I'd renew the motion to hold this over for possible inclusion into the Data Practices Omnibus Bill. Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Passes.
Yeah, we'll pass it off.
The record should reflect that I'm taking over temporarily for the chairman, who is has a bill to present. Representative Emmer, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move House File 1130 for possible inclusion in the data practices on this bill.
That's fine. Representative Emmer, would you like to present your bill?
I would. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The bill is an amendment to the Data Practices Act, and specifically Section 13.03, which has to do with the production, inspection, and copying of public records for citizens. As I understand it, this proposed language comes from the Newspaper Association.
Representative Emmer, we do have an author's amendment here, the A1 amendment. Would you like to move that so we have the bill in the form that you'd like to have it in?
I'm sorry. Yes, I would move the A1 amendment.
So moved. And any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
No opposed? The ayes have it. Here we go. We can proceed on, Representative Emmer.
Thank you. Last year, I understand there were several advisory opinions that had to be issued on this particular provision in the statute, which provides for the reasonable cost of locating and copying public records in response to citizens' requests. The problem has been that counties and local authorities don't have any consistent application of what the reasonable fee language means. This proposed amendment creates an exception to the rule that the local authority is allowed to charge a reasonable fee. What it does is, under the amendment, when you have a request that involves 100 copies, photocopies or less, black and white photocopies, the local authority may not charge the reasonable fee. Instead, it's set at a fee of 25 cents per copy. And then I'll stand for questions.
That's fine. Representative Holberg has a question.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Emmer, in reading this, it looks like your language that they could not charge less than 25 cents per copy. Was that your intent? Or would the bill be more to your liking if you added the words up to 25 cents per copy?
I have no problem with up to 25 cents. They should not be allowed to charge more than 25 cents.
Representative Emmer, would you like to make that an oral amendment?
Well, if somebody else would, I'd accept it.
I can't.
Right.
I'm not going to do all the work, Mr. Chairman.
The word up to.
All right. That's on line...
Line 5 of the amendment.
All right. So do we have the amendment properly stated? All those in favor of the oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Ayes have it. Representative Emmer, I believe there's another testifier today. If the testifier can come forward. Sir, please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, subcommittee, my name is Richard Neumeister. A very important part of our democracy and where citizens can involve themselves in our participatory and representative form of democracy is to be able to get access to information that is very important for them, for citizens, and as individuals and as groups, to be able to take a look at the information that the government keeps on all kinds of issues, and then to interact with themselves as citizens, and then with policymakers, administrators, or whatever that how government affects their lives. I have to give Representative Emmer credit and the Minnesota Newspaper Association for doing what they're trying to do here, but I don't think they've really addressed the issue here. And I'd like to offer some suggestions, and as you may know, this bill more than likely will be laid over, again, to include in the omnibus, to where some of the suggestions and points I make could maybe be thought upon as the bill progresses. First of all, I would like to talk about a public interest waiver. 16 states throughout the country have what they call a public interest waiver. And it goes similar like this as in the Wisconsin statute, which is typical. And let's maybe look at it from a Minnesota law. A responsible authority may provide copies of a record without charge or at a reduced charge where the authority determines that waiver or reduction is in the public interest. Quarter is a lot for folks who might want a 30-page memo detailing about how Ide Mill Road here in St. Paul is going to have an effect on their thing, on their community, or some of the cities and counties in which you live. So a public interest waiver has worked, and I think it would be a positive item. Number two, in being here at the legislature for many years, I'm aware that you set something as policy in one statute, and then what happens? Legislators and interest groups go around the particular statute. One of the concerns I have is, let's say you set a fee of 25 cents. And I'll give you an example again from my examples at various law enforcement entities to get, let's say you're interested in getting a copy of a police report, which is public. For the first page, some of them charge $4 or $5. Now, let's say law enforcement is interested to still charge that $4 or $5 rather than the up to 25 cents of being proposed. In some other statutes, they might say law enforcement records could be charged at such and such a page. So what I'm suggesting is some constrictive language that sort of says that if for purposes of public copies and access, other than things that are already in statute, this section has to be done in this section that is being proposed. Number three, and this is very much a disappointing part of the bill, and I think this is something that all of you members of the committee and other folks are aware of. It does not have anything dealing with the electronic computer access of records. It is no longer photocopying. What it is, let's say I'm looking for that 30-page memo that details about something I and maybe my co-citizens in our community want to do. So I'll go up to the city council, I'll go to the particular agency. Yes, I'm interested in this and this and this. Well, they say, oh, yes, we it's not no longer in the file, paper file, and where they have to get up and go over and photocopy it, which costs a little bit of labor and things like that. What they'll do, which all of you will now have, they'll look it up on their computer file. Oh, I'll get that for you in about 30 seconds, Mr. Neumeister. Boom. They file it, they find the file, press the button, and it comes out about maybe 40 seconds later. In some instances, less than a minute. Now, we see some of this happening now in our public libraries, where you see things that are on the web or whatever, you print, and it only costs 5 cents. Now, I did an informal survey about that, what that printer cost, 1.2 cents. And secondarily, in terms of the paper, cost from 1 to 3 cents. So, one of the things that I propose, that language be added to Mr. Emmer's bill that allows electronic copies in the format that I'm talking about be printed only 5 to 8 cents. Because I think, you know, it's important in that regard to really charge the actual cost and to be aware that we're dealing now with electronic records, and granted it's coming out on paper, but why charge an extra 15, 20 cents? Now, a lot of states are starting to take a look at this issue and go down that way, lessen cost, to lessen burden, and a lot of states have what actual cost being what it actually costs. It's also called direct cost, but not counting the cost of the labor. Do we pay an extra 20 cents for a person to push the button? The other thing, and I hear this from a lot of citizens, we pay folks now to work with citizens. That's one of part of their job responsibilities. And there have been court decisions that have said that. That when you pay a salary for the clerk or someone who, you know, on a request to get information from folks, that's part of their job. So why are you paying them double? The another thing is the enforcement. Now, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, enforcement is one of the key issues. As I said in another body, what some government entities will do and their representatives, if they decide to charge, no matter what the state says, and charge $2 a copy, $3 a copy, which they're going to do, which has been a long history, and then you, John Q. Citizen, well, you can, sure, you can ask for an opinion, but all enforcement still relies on you going to court. So you're going to go to court for, let's say, a $5 bill? No. In some states, there have been some decisions that have gone to the Supreme Court on cost, but I don't think in this state. So what the government entity may just do is did in another body, and so what are you left with? So my main point on the first point that I'm suggesting, that there be an enforcement mechanism for enforcement of fees through the opinion process in the Department of Administration. Now, we have done something similar to this as it deals with open meeting, which I believe Representative Holberg could have been the chief author of that bill, I don't remember for sure, on open meeting. And there's some other things that can be looked at. Now, for a final thought. In regards to prices for photocopies, I believe 25 cents is still a little bit too much. I suggest one page, 15 cents, and then 18 to 20 cents for a double side. So a total cost of 20 cents. The suggested amount is based on what Florida does and some other public entities. So that's my main point. I wanted to share some concerns with you about this bill. The premise of the bill is good, but I think it can be improved as it goes on its journey in the House of Representatives. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I want to thank you for the few moments of your time, and if there are any questions, I can stand for those. Also, just real quick, it hit me, you know, there's a lot of individuals. I know that parents like to get access to their kids' school records, and so would this fee apply to those records too, up to 100, or is it just for public records? That's what I have a concern about also. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Does the committee have any questions of Mr. Neumeister? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister, for digging into this and for looking at other aspects and how to improve it, and I think that's great. The question that I have for you is that in terms of public access to information and trying to get these copies, I know, like with a building, let's say a lot of municipal building codes are online only, and that's your only access to them, and that folks can get access to them through public buildings like the library or at City Hall, and they can pay for the printing of the, you know, appropriate sections that they're looking for at whatever the nominal cost is, 5 cents or 10 cents a piece usually, I think. What is your interest in this exception to those portions of public or non-public records, like you said, police reports? Are you particularly interested in only those areas that the average person couldn't get online, or is this an access of who has online access versus who doesn't?
Mr. Neumeister.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dean, in regards if I'm sitting at home and I go online, and I'm doing my search, and I want, basically, I'm printing myself. So there, and we've taken care of that in our law to where there's no charge. So there's not going to be like that. Now, in regards to the police, which they have a lot of public records, I would, you know, all this would deal with at least all public records, and I'm going to say it should deal with private records that are about you. You know, whatever that fee up to those 100 pages. The nominal cost is going to vary, you know, depending on what one says their cost is. I've given you at least an example of where a library now is just the cost. Some entities, public entities, are now starting to set up terminals at their place to where someone can come in. But no matter how they do it, whether it be in the computerized form or the photocopy form, it should be the least cost, not to be of a commercial value, because the commercial value is not there when a citizen wants to be able to use some information to better their community and to disagree in our First Amendment realm of discussion of political and social issues.
Mr. Chairman, would it be all right if I responded to Mr. Neumeister's concerns?
Certainly, Representative Emmer.
First, on the public interest waiver, I think this is one of the reasons this bill has been introduced, is because there has been a difference in application of the current law. What I'd be concerned with, if you put a waiver in, such as Mr. Neumeister has suggested, is you would have the same problem. How are the local authorities going to determine who gets the waiver, who pays, and who doesn't pay? And when Mr. Neumeister is talking about actual cost, that's the other problem, is that the statute, the way it's written right now, talks about reasonable cost, a reasonable charge. The thing that he's left out in his analysis is it's not just the cost of the paper. It's not just the cost of pushing the button. It's also the cost to have that employee, the human resource, locate the information and produce it. In a response to Representative Dean's question, the difference is illustrated by his question. That's a situation where a citizen can get access to the information on his or her own and print it at their own cost, as opposed to having an employee of the local authority take the time and effort to locate the information and produce it. In response to his issue about his greatest disappointment with the bill, I would disagree with him, because if you take a look at the statute as it now exists, it talks about the reasonable authority, and this is, by the way, in 13.03 subdivision 3, subpart C, where it starts off, the responsible authority or designee shall provide copies of public data upon request. And then the next sentence specifically states, if a person requests copies or electronic transmittal of data to the person. So in my reading of the statute and the proposed amendment to the law, it would apply. In essence, what this proposed bill is intended to do is to resolve many, if not all, of the questions that Mr. Neumeister is raising. Lastly, he talks about, and I guess I can't really repeat his illustration of what if government doesn't do what the law says it's supposed to do. My understanding is that the law still has some very stiff penalties. Number one, a citizen who's not been treated properly by a local authority can prove up his or her actual damages. Number two, the public authority that does not follow the letter of the law can be subject to civil sanctions, I believe, of up to $10,000. And there's a provision within the Data Practices Act that provides for attorney's fees as well. So the way the law is drafted, there's plenty of enforcement protection already within the existing law. Again, all this proposed House file is intended to do is take care of the problem that Mr. Neumeister has raised, where a citizen goes into a local authority, and I think the example that Mr. Neumeister used was the police department, and requests one page, and the charge is $4 to $5. Under this circumstance, the charge would be 25 cents, which seems to make the intent of the law is to make public information accessible to the public, and this seems to do that. Thank you.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if Mr. Antonsen would be willing to answer some questions. My understanding is this came from the Newspaper Association, and I'm thinking he probably had a hand in the language.
That's fine. We can come down, Mr. Appleton. I would like to caution the committee that we have to wrap up by 11, so Mr. Ampson, I would request that you make your comments brief and direct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I didn't realize that the committee was going to end at 11. I apologize for that, and certainly we can discuss this more later, but I have a couple questions on the language. When you say, if 300 and fewer paper copies, is this of the same record, or could, in the case of a chiropractor go in for 300 different accident requests, and each would be a quarter? And was there any discussion in this working group about using the data for commercial purposes versus an individual just requesting information? I mean, as I read it, I think that you could request 300 separate different accident requests each day, or 100, I'm sorry, each day, every day that the cop shop was open, and use them for commercial purposes, and that would be okay.
Mr. Appleton.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, I think you're correct. I think it would be 25 cents per copy, although I would hasten to add that most of those types of copies are pretty readily accessible in the police department. It is, of course, 100 copies now. Part of the reason we proposed reducing it from the ceiling from 300 to 100 is to limit some of the potentially abusive manipulations of the statute.
Okay, so just for initial clarification, Mr. Chair, you would say
would
be 100 per day was your intent, and that didn't matter if it was 100 different events versus 100 copies of the same data sheet.
Mr.
Chairman, Representative Holberg, that's correct. We concluded, we did talk about these issues, we concluded that the difficulties of making some of these definitions and drawing some of the lines around the categories you're suggesting would outweigh the benefit over time.
Okay, thank you.
We do have one more testifier, Ms. Twyla Brace, or Brace.
Mark.
Please. Ms. Brace, please state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Twyla Brace, Citizens Council on Healthcare. And I'm just going to comment and add something. I have a page bringing around an actual two pages of a document that, of two different documents of charges that our organization received as a result of asking for information. One is from the Department of Health, and the other is from the Office of Administrative Hearings. And I should have given you a couple of these to be coming around. And the one that you'll see from the Office of Administrative Hearings is at 25 cents per page for 113 pages. And the other one from the Department of Health for 781 pages was at 4.5 cents a copy. And I wanted to bring this as a clear example of what happens, because from the Health Department, we basically got charged 10 cents a page, which was great. And from the Office of Administrative Hearings, we got charged 25 cents a page. And had we been charged 25 cents a page from the Office of from the Department of Health, it would have been almost $200. So there's a significant difference between 10 cents and 25 cents. This bill, with the amendment as I see it now, is at a maximum of 25 cents for the first 100 copies, and after that it's reasonable. And I guess it's dependent upon, you know, what reasonable is and what they would decide. But I bring this as an example. And the other, and so it's a concern, especially from an organization like ours, which is small, as opposed to, let's just say, the news agency, which has hundreds of people and millions of dollars, and they can make decisions about, or they can have more money in order to get this kind of information. So I don't know if, Ms. Zimmer, if you have thought of having that as a distinction between small little nonprofits versus others, or, and the other thing I would say is for electronic data is that could be perhaps even half the cost, because there is no cost of actually standing by a copier and copying, or paper costs. So let me just throw that out. Those aren't necessarily concrete suggestions, but they just give you a flavor from a small nonprofit organization.
Any questions for Ms. Brace? Seeing no questions, we'll thank you, Ms. Brace, for your remarks. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to comment on House File 1130 as amended? Thank you, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Hi, my name is Kurt Yoakum. I'm policy analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I'll be real brief. Thank you for the opportunity to make a couple comments, and we do appreciate the committee hearing this bill. The Association of Minnesota Counties represents all 87 counties in the state, and we are not here to oppose the bill. I think our members are all over the map on this. The Department of Administration back in October brought together quite a few interested parties, including the Newspaper Association, representatives of local governments and state agencies on this. And there are definitely some concerns. And the only things that we wanted to just point out as the committee moves this bill forward and as it's considered for the omnibus data practice itself is just a few things. As I said, our members are all over the map on this. Some of our folks do take the issue of local control very seriously, and they just assume not have the state telling them what the specific price of the copy should be. Other folks have just said, last week the other body had debated this bill, and there are quite a few folks out there that do waive a considerable amount of copying costs, and a lot of our counties have also just said, you know, we just assume have a statewide fee, so we're not having to deal with this every year. Quite frankly, nobody really wants to go through iPad request series and debate the merits of what a particular fee is. The cautions that I just want to put out there is, in a lot of ways, just like the state, county government is very complex operations. Each county, regardless if it's tiny Monoma County or large Hennepin County, there are quite a few different departments out there. And matter of fact, quite a few of our operations, almost every one of our operations has some sort of state statute surrounding how it operates. And there are state statutes that are recording that are involve very set numbers for different fees. Now, the Department of Administration has mentioned to me that this bill is the general, and if there are state statutes that are affecting fees already in law, that those would supersede this. But there's obviously opportunity for confusion in county offices, and we just want to make sure that that's not a problem. And just the other thing is as we see with data practices all the time, whether it's local governments, whether it's the Newspaper Association, private citizens, we're in here constantly asking for clarifications or changes. So just we want to caution you to please be very careful with what you put in law when it comes to this. You know, I have a tendency, I guess, a reputation of being annoying over the minutia. We don't want to be in here every year asking either for a clarification of what is covered or what is not, or we don't want to be in here 5 years from now asking the legislature to please increase a fee that is set in statute, and how do we deal with inflation or whichever. So those are just some of the concerns that we wanted to bring up, and I'll stand for any questions. Otherwise, that was my testimony.
Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Emmer.
I just add, so we're all clear that the statute right now provides for no charge to inspect any and all public records. I think that's important for clarification. This isn't a matter of whether someone's going to get access to the records, because there is no charge to inspect. This is purely for the photocopies.
Any other questions for the testifier? Seeing none, thank you very much, sir. Are there any other persons wishing to testify on House File 1130 as amended? Seeing none, Representative Emmer renews his motion to pass House File 1130 as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Ayes have it. As Representative Emmer makes his way forward, let me let you know we're going to have an overview on government data practices at this time with Katie Engler, Information and Policy Analysis with the Division of the Department of Administration. So I did misspeak. We're not ending at 11. We're just going on to other business. Thank you.
Ms. Engler, welcome back. Do you want to introduce yourself and your company? And we're going to have an overview on the incredibly interesting
Minnesota Data Practices Act.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Katie Engler with the Department of Administration. Before I introduce Lori Byer-Kopinski, I wanted to tell members that in their packet they have a two-page outline that we're going to be following today, and then they have several pages stapled together that are the handouts to which we are going to be referring. We hope that this will help make it a little easier for you to follow us today. With that, I'd like to introduce Lori Byer-Kopinski, who is the Director of the Information Policy Analysis Division, and she's going to start us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We're all here to talk about the Data Practices Act, and we have a reputation for not always being the most exciting topic on the block. But Katie and I, and we hope that we will instill this in you as well, we think it's really interesting and challenging and a lot of fun. So we're going to do an overview of the Data Practices Act, and we have asked the Chair's indulgence also as we go through the information. We have a number of case studies and scenarios that we'd like to go through with you and see. We don't often get an opportunity to quiz you guys, so we would like to be able to do that. We're going to start off with some definitions and then move on to the rights of individuals and then the duties and responsibilities of government and then finish up with what is the legislature's role and what have you reserved onto yourselves. First, I wanted to do a quick overview. The Information Policy Analysis Division, IPAD as it's generally known, is a small division in the Department of Administration. We have 5.5 full-time employees, and we do a variety of work. We serve citizens, the legislature, government, media, pretty much anyone. So you'll be seeing an awful lot of us because one of our biggest tasks is to help make sure that policy in this area is written in the best way that it can be and that there aren't unintended consequences or conflicts with federal and other state laws. So you'll see us often. What we do, the first handout that you have is an overview of the office that kind of goes through our different responsibilities. We help the Commissioner of Administration with her statutory obligations. In the last 10 years, IPAD has issued over, helped the Commissioner issue over 700 opinions in the data practices area, clarifying those areas of law, and they can be requested both by government entities or citizens. In 2003, the legislature gave the Commissioner of Administration the additional ability to issue advisory opinions in the open meeting law. So we are becoming the data practices subject matter expert as well as open meeting law. So we will also come to you with some of those issues as well. The Commissioner has duties in a variety of areas, including evaluating and issuing temporary classifications, as Representative Holberg illustrated, handling data challenges and appeals, applications for new uses of data. Then next up, we have technical assistance and consultation that we provide to all of our stakeholders, including citizens, the media, and government. Each year, we help over 8,000 of those people with from the most simple question about data practices to the most complicated. So we have a lot of people who turn to us for that kind of advice. And then the reason why you're seeing us here today, we do help with legislation. We help anyone who comes to the door who wants feedback on their legislative proposals or will follow bills and make sure that someone who might have a subject matter they're particularly adept in but might have data classification issues. So we'll make sure that bills are, you know, all the hoops and everything are tied together. Lastly, our website has a ton of resources, and you have the next handout you have goes through the variety of resources that we have on our website, including the 700-plus advisory opinions. On a quarterly basis, we have about 20,000 visits to our website. So there are lots of folks who are looking at our website for the information, model policies, training materials, advisory opinions, and other things like our electronic newsletter. So we have a variety of ways that we try and help everyone because this is a complex area of law that many people have struggled with how to navigate. We also, lastly, as budget and time allows, we provide training, but we also have training materials that anyone can pick up and use. And with that, next up, Katie is going to go into the rights of individuals and some general definitional issues. Mr. Chair and members, thought it would be helpful for you to know who's covered by the Data Practices Act. Probably first and foremost is the legislature is not covered by the Data Practices Act, nor is the judiciary. So what we're really talking about is what's commonly known as the executive branch of government, state agencies, counties, cities, school districts. And then in 2001,
was the metropolitan area townships were added to the list of government entities covered by the Act. So, and the basis for that was that there are some townships in the metro area that are larger than some cities, and so was felt appropriate to include them in the coverage of the Data Practices Act. The other major issue is what is covered. And government data is defined as data that is held in a physical medium, meaning it's on a piece of paper, it's in a computer, it's on an audio tape or a videotape. In other words, there's some way that you can handle the data. And there are, in fact, a couple of cases that specifically say that data that are held only in the minds of government employees are not covered by the Data Practices Act. And sometimes that can get make an analysis of a situation tricky. The next handout you have in your packet has a tombstone in the middle. It's the easiest way to refer to it. The classification scheme that's been created by the legislature sets out one in total 9 different classifications for data. And the major divisions are data on individuals, meaning data on human beings, data on decedents, and then data not on individuals. And by data, the phrase not on individuals is intended to refer to any type of organization or group that is not human, so like corporations or other types of businesses. And you'll see that for each one of these three groups, there are 3 different classifications of data. All 3 of the groups have a classification of public, which means that the data are accessible to anyone for any reason. And then the concepts remain the same for the other classification groups, but they're labeled different things based on whether the data are about individuals or not about individuals. And I'm going to focus on the data on individuals because that's, I think, where most people have an interest. Data that are classified as private are those data that are accessible to the individual who is the subject of the data, and also to those government employees whose work assignment reasonably requires them to have access. Confidential data, on the other hand, is only accessible to those government employees whose work assignment reasonably requires access. So in other words, an example would be that police department is conducting an active criminal investigation, and Section 13.82 says that active criminal investigative data are confidential. That means that the person who is the subject of the investigation cannot see the data about him or herself that the police department has so long as that investigation is active. The other thing that we would like to talk a little bit about today is that the Data Practices Act works with 2 other statutes that have been enacted. The first is something called the Official Records Act. It's in Section 15.17, and what this says is that public officials are required to keep those records necessary for a full and complete knowledge of their official activities. In other words, why did they do what they did? And in many advisory opinions issued by the Commissioner of Administration, there will be a discussion of this statutory requirement, because government will have taken some action, and then when they receive a data practices request, will say, we don't have any data that document that transaction. And the commissioner will talk about the fact that there is this obligation in state law that there be enough records so that in the future someone can understand why a decision was made, or that the successor in office can understand why their predecessor acted in a particular manner. The other major statute that intersects with the Data Practices Act is something called the Records Management Act. This is the law that says how government entities can dispose of government records. And in essence, what is necessary is for government to have permission from a group called the Records Disposition Panel before they can dispose of government records, whether it be throw them away or recycle the magnetic tape for a computer or something else. And this record disposition panel is made up of the executive director of the Minnesota Historical Society, the Office of the Attorney General, and then for state agency records, the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and for all local government agencies, the Office of the State Auditor. So I see if there's a question.
Excuse me, Ms. Engler. Representative Holberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Engler, did you happen to catch the article in the paper this weekend about the private, the records, the titles, et cetera, being in a bundle at some recycling facility in Wisconsin? And do you have any comments on the legality of that?
Ms. Engler?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, yes, I did see the article. I had a chance to skim it. I hope that the Department of Public Safety has a records retention schedule that's been approved that allows them to dispose of those particular records, and it sounds like they might need to find a new vendor who's going to secure that data in a little bit different way. My understanding is that someone was able to walk past basically a pile of paper and grab a handful of what was there. So,
and Mr. Chair, for clarification purposes, does the state law allow that, or would it be against the law for DPS to dispose of it in a manner in which it could be blowing around a neighborhood and accessible to individuals?
Ms. Engler?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, the real question is what's the classification of the data contained in the records? And if the data in the records are classified as something that's not public, then there would need to be a secure way to destroy or dispose of those records so that they're not, as you said, blowing around the neighborhood. So that's the real issue, is what's the classification of the data in the records.
All right, thank you.
All right. Please continue, Ms. Engler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other thing that I think is helpful for you to understand as you start working with these data practices issues is that there is a presumption in the statute in Section 13.03 that all government data are public unless there is a federal law, meaning either a federal statute or a regulation, or a state statute enacted by you, or a temporary classification that makes the data not public. And so in looking at data practices issues, we always begin with the presumption that the data are public and then determine whether or not either a federal law or a state statute exists to decide whether or not the data are somehow classified in a different way. And if you would turn to the fourth page in your packet.
Excuse me, Ms. Engler. Representative Hilke?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Engler, before we go further, you mentioned the possibility of a temporary classification. Mm-hmm. Who would have the authority to make that?
Ms. Engler?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilke, the statute gives authority to the Commissioner of Administration to act on requests for temporary classification of data, and then once each calendar year, the commissioner is required to report those temporary classifications to the legislature, who then has the opportunity to either make the classifications permanent or to declare that they are not to continue, and that's how the data are permanently classified.
Okay.
Any other questions? Please continue, Ms. Engler.
If you'll look at the next page in your handout, we promised you some questions that we would like to ask you, and we thought we'd do it based on small increments of information that we've provided. So you'll see that the first situation says that a constituent calls your office and asks for help in obtaining information about a conditional use permit for her property that was granted by the township in which she lives. The permit was granted in 2004. How do you determine if the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act applies?
And which representative did you want to ask that question of?
Whoever would like to answer it.
I'll take one of these.
Representative Holber.
It depends if they're metro or non-metro.
That is correct. It does.
Does she get a prize or a treat?
We should have thought of that.
Sorry. Ms. Engler.
Thank you. The second situation goes on to say that you've determined that the constituent lives in a township that has to comply with Chapter 13, which is the number assigned to the Data Practices Act. And so she makes a data practices request for data about the conditional use permit involving her property. She has come back to you because she is told that the township does not have any data that documents the granting of the permit. Is this a problem?
Anyone want to take that one? Isn't this a it might be? Isn't that the answer? It might be a problem?
It might be a problem because the question is, if there was a conditional use permit granted, where is the official record that documents the granting of the permit? Which means there ought to be some data if there was a permit that was in fact granted. So, yes, it probably is a problem if they're saying they do not have any data.
We're, as lawyers, we're taught to answer it that way. It might be.
Mr. Chair, I understand that philosophy of answering questions.
Ms. Engler, please continue.
Thank you. We're going to turn now to rights of individuals because the Data Practices Act, really when it boils down to it, is a balancing of rights of individuals versus responsibilities of government entities. And so we thought it would be helpful if you'd know what some of the rights are that have been granted by the statute. And the first one is that before private or confidential data are collected from an individual, they are supposed to receive a notice telling them why the data are being collected, what the statutory basis is for collecting the data, whether or not they're required to answer or give the data, and finally, who outside of the entity collecting the data will get access to those data. And this is known in the vernacular as a Tennyson warning, named for Senator Robert Tennyson, who was instrumental in enacting the legislation. And we have a lot of people who call us and say, we can't find this Tennyson warning thing. Well, that's because nowhere in statute is the word Tennyson used, but it refers to the notice required in Section 13.04, Subdivision 2. Also, individuals are entitled to find out if they are the subject of public, private, or confidential data. So, for example, the most popular example here that's used is that you can go to the local police department and ask if you're the subject of confidential data. And if the answer is yes, you are, that must mean that there's an active criminal investigation that somehow involves you. But in essence, what the government entity's responsibility is here is to answer the question, do you have data about me and how are they classified? And so it's not necessarily to produce the data, but rather to say whether or not data exists about you as an individual. As individuals are entitled to access public and private data about themselves. And at this point, I should also note that parents are entitled to access data about their minor children. And also in those situations where there has been a guardian appointed, the guardian is entitled to access data on behalf of the person for whom they serve as guardian. Access means that if they are seeking access to private data, for example, if you want to see your children's school records, those data are classified as private, and it is appropriate for the school district to ask you for some sort of identification to prove that you are, in fact, entitled to have access. And it's up to each government entity to determine what type of identification they believe is appropriate before they give you access to private data. You are also entitled to be informed of the content and the meaning of data that are about you. For example, if a report uses acronyms or terms that you don't understand, you're entitled to have those acronyms and terms explained to you so that you can understand what the data are about. You are entitled to have access to data whenever there is a dispute about the data, when additional data has been collected about you, or once every 6 months. And so there are some folks out there who make it a career, shall we say, out of asking for data about themselves. And so unless the data are in dispute or they have been new data that have been either collected or created by a government entity, they get access to those data about themselves once every 6 months. Individuals are entitled to have access to data about themselves immediately, if that is possible, and no later than 10 working days after they have made their request. And this is an area where sometimes government entities have problems complying with the statute. If you're an individual who has a lot of government data, it may take them a little bit longer to pull it all together. And this is also that you are to have access to the data within 10 working days, not that the government entity acknowledges that you've made a request within 10 working days. So it's an area where there is some tension between individuals and government entities.
Ms. Engler, a question. When someone makes a request that is not complied with within the 10 days or can't be, what happens?
Mr. Chair, if an individual were to call our office or the government entity were to call, we would recommend a couple of things. One, that the government entity produce whatever they possibly could within the 10 working days and explain to the individual why it's going to take longer to finish the data production. We're going to also counsel an individual to try to get that government entity to comply in that way. But if the government entity just plain isn't willing to comply with the statutory requirements, the individual has a couple of different options. One is that they can request that the Commissioner of Administration issue an advisory opinion about the particular situation. The other option that they have is that they can use the enforcement provisions in Section 13.08 and take the government entity to court, which obviously is an expensive choice. But those are the options that the individual would have available to them. Clarify a point from the House File 1130. Individuals pay for the actual cost of copies of data. They do not pay search and retrieval as is allowed for public data. House File 1130 only amends the public data provision of the statute. And so the question Mr. Neumeister had about whether or not parents would have access to their children's records would be controlled by House File 1130. The answer is no. You're only amending the section of the statute, Section 13.03, that governs copies of public data. So things like financial data at a school district or city council minutes or county policies on something. That's the type of data that and the copies that you're addressing with that bill. Individuals have the right to challenge the accuracy and or completeness of public or private data about themselves. For example, if my employer, the Department of Administration, had incorrectly recorded my birth date, I would have the option of challenging that data to get them to correct it. And there's an administrative process that can be used if you cannot get satisfaction at the government entity where the data are held. There can be an appeal to the Commissioner of Administration and a contested case hearing and a whole process that allows citizens the opportunity to get data corrected. Individuals also have the ability, when the government wants to use the data in a new way or disseminate it to a new group of organizations or individuals, that the individual controls that new use or dissemination through the use of something called informed consent. This is the written document where you give your permission for the data to be used in a new or different way. Data on individuals must be accurate, complete, and current. And finally, individuals seeking access to public data cannot be required to identify themselves, state why they want access to the data, or what they're going to do with it as a condition of receiving access to the data. This was an amendment from about 2000. That is the result of a survey that was done by a group called the Information Policy Task Force. It was a legislative and executive branch group that met for about a year and came up with some recommendations. They sent out what they called secret shoppers to different government entities and asked for access to public data and then recorded the reactions that they got. And they intentionally sent people to places where they would not be recognized. Because, of course, in many small communities, it's very easy. Everybody knows who the local newspaper reporter is. And so you can guess why they're asking for access to data. And so requests were on the order of, well, how much is the superintendent's salary in this school district? And because the response was, who are you and why do you want to know, the legislature passed this amendment that said that you cannot ask those kinds of questions and make answering them a condition of getting access to public data. Because if it's truly public, it's available to anyone for any reason. And so it shouldn't matter who you are or what you're going to do with the data once you get it. And with that, I'd like to turn to the next set of problems, please. And you are an employee of the City of Frozen Moon's Police Department. You are a designee of the city's responsible authority and are responsible for data practices requests that involve law enforcement data. The department currently has an active criminal investigation into the activities of Arthur Schmedlap, and the data are classified as confidential. Mr. Schmedlap has just arrived at the department and wants to know if there are data about him and how are they classified. What do you do?
Who wants this one? Representative Hilty.
I presume that you tell him that they exist and are classified as confidential, and that's all you do.
That is correct.
Ms. Engler.
The second situation says, on learning that there are public, private, and confidential data about him at the Frozen Moon Police Department, Mr. Schmedlap demands access to the data. How soon do you have to provide access? To what data may Mr. Schmedlap have access? And if Mr. Schmedlap identifies some data as being inaccurate, what can be done?
Anyone? I'll go ahead. You have to provide data within 10 days. You can only provide public data, which in this case I suspect is going to be his name. I don't know that there's anything else. Because you'd have to know what's in the file, and then if something's inaccurate, he can get his private stuff too. Mm-hmm. So I guess he can get his name, his address, his birth date. And then if his birth date is wrong, I suspect if it's that he's too old, he can challenge it. If he's too young, he'll probably leave it the same. Is that Ms. England?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The individual gets access to public or private data. The only clarification I would make is that the access is to be within 10 working days, so that we don't count Saturdays, Sundays, and holidays in calculating that.
Well, with all due respect, I think we count them around here. Just two more working days for Monday. Please continue.
And you are correct that Mr. Schmedlap gets access to the public and private data about himself. And he does have the ability to use the data challenge process to try to correct whatever he identifies as inaccurate or incomplete. The last situation here is that you are employed by the City of Frozen Moon and have data practices responsibilities. One of your duties is to talk to people who want access to data maintained by the city. A person is standing in front of you and is asked to access data relating to customers of the city water utility. The city's data request form asks for the individual's name, address, phone number, a description of the data requested, and why they want to have access to the data. You give them the request form, and the citizen only completes the portion of the form that requests the data description. You ask to have the rest of the form completed. The person refuses. Now what happens? And by the way, water utility data are public.
Representative Nelson.
That's correct.
Thank you. Ms. Engler.
Now Ms. Byer-Kopensky's turn.
Mr. Chair and members, the next area is the responsibilities and duties of government. And one of the first terms we use is the responsible authority, and that is the person of the Data Practices Act who has a whole variety of responsibilities in this area. And one of the toughest things, I think, for citizens sometimes to figure out is who is the responsible authority. And for state agents, for state departments, it is the commissioner. But in cities and counties, the county board or city council needs to designate a person who is an employee of the city or a county to serve as the responsible authority for that area. And in addition, for the University of Minnesota, an individual needs to be appointed by the Board of Regents. Any other state agency who isn't a department, it would be the chief executive officer of that agency would be the responsible authority. And, sorry, just a little, I have a newborn, so I'm not always shooting on all cylinders. So, next up. To reemphasize how important you thought each agency having a responsible authority was, you designated that there should be a data practices compliance official, that each agency would designate that person as well, and that person should be an employee of the government entity. And that person is meant to be the person that citizens or anyone who is having difficulty in getting a request handled or has any issues with data practice would go to that person, and they do kind of troubleshooting. For the Department of Public Safety, I served as their data practice compliance official. And often, a citizen would go to one of our entities within the department and ask for something, and they would not receive satisfaction. And they would then be turned over to me, and I would either explain again why they could have access or couldn't have access to certain information, or then direct the employee of the division to say, no, this is public information. The person doesn't have to identify themselves. They don't have to say why they want it, and give them clarification. So someone who is knowledgeable in data practices and helps citizens kind of navigate the process. The responsible authority has a variety of responsibilities. And one of your next handout is the compliance checklist, which is one of the things that is on our website. And it talks about all of the, from Chapter 13, all the responsibilities that the responsible authority has, including establishing procedures to ensure that officials within their agency respond promptly to requests for government data, preparing a public document setting forth the rights of data subjects to access about public and private data about themselves, establishing procedures to ensure that data on individuals are accurate, complete, and current. And also establishing reasonable security procedures to ensure that there are safety precautions for data on individuals, such as the bales of information that were described in the paper. Any department should have security procedures to ensure that data is only accessed by the people who have a work reason for seeing it, that your listing of your social security numbers for your employees doesn't sit in your main receptionist desk so that anyone walking by should see them, that you should keep certain things under lock and key or in different ways depending on the level of security that they need. Each year, the entity is to create and update an inventory of all the records that they have on individuals and the classification of that information. And then you also have, when preparing contracts, all government entities should have provisions that their contractors who do work for them are subject to the Data Practices Act, that you cannot circumvent Chapter 13 by just having a contractor do your work for you, that they are subject to Chapter 13 just as you would be. The entity also must formulate a plan for reviewing and the administration of data practices within their agency, and also providing training to their employees on how to do it. So those are all responsible authority responsibilities. In addition, there are other ones and rules that you can see about what the responsible authority should do. Preparing public documents, identifying who is the responsible authority, their name, their title, their address. I have joked often, and I'm sure it's often not funny, but that there are many people, especially the commissioners of our state departments, who might not know that they are. They might not be familiar with Data Practices Act, and they don't actually know that they're the responsible authority. So it's good that so that their data practices compliance official can tell them, and this is the role that you serve. And as I already mentioned, each government entity, as of December of 2000, needed to appoint a compliance official, and they also need to post all the names of their data practices designees, and then also train their designees and their other staff on how to comply with this. Now, Katie is going to, oh, we have our problems to solve. I don't want to miss my opportunity for this one. The first situation is the Frozen Moon School Board adopts a resolution appointing the personnel director the responsible authority for personnel data in the district. Is this appropriate?
Anyone? Representative Dean, are you?
Mr. Chair, it depends.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean,
thanks.
In this particular instance, it's not an it depends. Well, we have to take this opportunity. We're never going to get it again.
I don't think Representative Dean has a newborn.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, no, this isn't appropriate. What they need to do is say, by resolution, they need to designate the actual name of the person who it's going to be. So it can't just be a position that's named. Even though we understand why it might be a simpler process, what you need is to have a human being and their name designated in your resolution as your responsible authority.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Holbrook.
A question for Ms. Byer-Kopinski. Can you have different responsible authorities for different segments of data?
Ms. Byer-Kopinski.
In a county situation, you would have all the elected officials are the responsible authority for their own data, but any data that would be outside of those elected officials' office, the county would need to designate someone. So in the instance of a county, you can have multiple places. And then also there's the county social service agencies where they, by statute, have their own responsible authorities designated.
But so it can be a
mix. But Mr. Chair and Ms. Byer-Kopinski, I'm going off of your situation here. You have a school board. So you're talking about school data. Mm-hmm. Is it lawful for the school board to have a personnel director in charge of one data set, i.e. personnel data, and have another responsible authority, say, be in charge of school records data, and another responsible authority within the same school district to be in charge of, say, fiscal data?
Ms. Byer-Kopinski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, in the situation of a school district, by rules of Department of Administration, the school board is allowed to designate an employee for school district information.
Representative Holbrook.
But there are specific instances where you can have multiple responsible authorities within the same political subdivision.
I'm sorry, that was Ms. Byer-Kopinski. I'll get it right eventually.
Thank you.
I don't have a newborn either. Representative Holbrook.
No, that was my question, if you could have more than one responsible authority designated to different data sets within one government entity.
All right.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Holbrook, I think that's why citizens sometimes have a very difficult time finding the appropriate responsible authority for the data that they're interested in. Because it isn't always simple. It's not just like with the State Department where you just know you go to the commissioner.
All right. Ms. Byer-Kopinski.
The second situation is in the effort to make law enforcement data more accessible to law enforcement officers, Frozen Loon County develops a database and invites cities in the county to enter data into the system. Data are accessed and entered via the Internet. There are no rules or policies that govern what can and cannot be entered into the database. The Sheriff's Department enters gun permit transactions, the City of Frozen Loon enters juvenile data, and the City of Frozen Duck enters only their traffic stops. Are there data security issues?
Does the sky blue and do ducks fly?
On this one, I just say yes. How's that?
Mr. Chair, you are correct. They need to take reasonable security depending on the data that they
have. I had a 50-50 chance. All right. Do you want to please continue?
Are there other issues that a responsible authority must address?
Anyone want to take that one?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Holbrook.
So we are in situation two?
Yes.
We are. We're with the City of Frozen Duck.
Yeah, there's like a gazillion issues here. There's security, access. They put in gun permit stuff that's under law you can't put in. Can't put in the juvenile data that's not proper. Tennyson warnings may or may not have been given. This mirrors a situation that had actually happened. It's a major problem.
Mr. Chair and members, if we had known Representative Holbrook would be here, we would have made the problems a lot harder. And she's correct. She's just going through the
Kopinski.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Going through the compliance checklist, there are a variety of responsibilities as Representative Holbrook. Informed consent, Tennyson warnings, reasonable security, access procedures, the whole slew of what they're responsible for. So the last situation is you're recently, and this is going to be a shameless plug, and I'll admit that on the front side. You are hired by the City of Frozen Duck to be the city administrator. The city council has, by name, appointed you the responsible authority. A citizen appears at your office wanting to know why there are no data practices, policies, and procedures for the city. What do you do? what resources are available to help you?
I believe we call you.
Mr. Chair and members, that is correct.
I only take the easy ones. We're saving Representative Dean for the next one. Ms. Engler.
Mr. Chair and members, as you work through data practices bills this year and in the future, there will be many occasions where people will refer to federal law that classifies data, and we thought it might be helpful if you had at least heard the names of the basic laws that you might hear. And in fact, we know how popular right now Social Security numbers are as a topic, given Choice Point and some other issues that are going on in the country. And so the last items in your handout packet are some information about Social Security numbers and what this does. The first handout is to show you how much Congress controls who gets to have access to our Social Security number. In preparing this and updating it, I finally had to stop because I was afraid it was going to be 10 pages long by the time I got done quoting the federal law. And when I got to, you can use a Social Security number as an identifier at a blood bank, I decided it was time to stop. So you have the basic provisions to talk about what are supposed to be the restrictions on the use of the Social Security number. And what's really pertinent is what's labeled Section 7 of Public Law 93-579. This is part of the Federal Privacy Act of 1974. And what the last handout tells you is that when a government entity wants to collect your Social Security number, there are certain pieces of information that they're supposed to give you before you provide your Social Security number. And those are summarized on that last handout. The notice that's required under the federal law is similar to our Tennyson warning notice in that it's supposed to give people some idea of what's going to happen to that Social Security number. Other federal laws that you may hear about, the first one is called the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, known by the acronym FERPA. This governs data not only at K-12 schools, but also at institutions of higher education. And it's one of the laws that preempts the field for how data are classified. And our state data section, 13.32, mirrors many of the federal provisions intentionally to keep us in line with the federal law. HIPAA, or the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, is something you may all have experienced the last time you went to the doctor's office because you were asked to sign something that said that you got their notice, what's called a notice of privacy practices, which was probably a very densely typed one or two-sided piece of paper. I hope that before you signed anything, you read what you were signing, because in some instances, the healthcare providers are using this as an opportunity to get your consent for all kinds of things, like taking photographs of parts of your body and some other things like that. So, but HIPAA covers medical records, particularly in the private sector, but also in some public sector entities. The Driver's Privacy Protection Act governs how the state-level organizations that deal with motor vehicle and driver's license data can handle that data and who can have access. There are about 14 exceptions in the federal law, which makes for interesting analysis of issues relating to driver's licenses and motor vehicles. And finally, there are rules at the federal level on access to data about people who have received treatment for chemical dependency. The premise behind the rules is that there is very strict limitation on who can have access and in what circumstances in order to encourage people to seek chemical dependency treatment. And with that, I will turn it over to Ms. Byer-Kopensky for the final section.
Mr. Chair members, I'm so glad you have managed to stay awake for all of this. And what I've saved for last is the most important part. What is your role in all of this? What are the authorities and responsibilities that you have reserved onto yourselves? And the first is classifying data as not public. Under Section 1303, Subdivision 1, only the legislature can classify data as not public. You also can control the sharing of not public data under Section 1305, Subdivision 4B. as we've already talked about earlier, you review the any temporary classification of data that has been granted by the Commissioner of Administration each year. And as we already mentioned, there are none for this 2005 session. But each year you would have the opportunity to see whether or not you agreed with those temporary classifications that she had issued. And then lastly, and the biggest, and we are always here to help, but you are given the task of balancing the government need and use for data with individual rights. And the Data Practices Act was established to ensure that there would be transparency in government. So there's always the question of weighing the privacy interests with the interests of government in doing their work. So you have reserved on yourself the toughest task. So we want to thank you for that and offer that we are always here to provide assistance. And we'll always be in the corner waving when we have, when there's some unintended consequence we want to help you avoid and help with your drafting. So thank you very much for this opportunity. Are there any questions?
Thank the both of you. I was just going to ask, any questions? I believe that concludes our activities for the day. We are adjourned. Thank you.
I'll call this meeting of the Civil Law and Elections Committee meeting to order. The legislative committee legislative assistant will note the roll and Representative West will move the minutes for February 23rd, 2005. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. All right, our first bill on the agenda is House File 607, Representative Ellison.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Representative Ellison, for the record. Mr. Chair, I do have a few testifiers. Would the Chair prefer that I would call them up now? In the interest of time?
Yeah, why don't you do that? That'd be great. And then if you want to move your bill, then we can
I'll do that. So if I could ask Mr. Reed to come up, Ms. Gaines, Ms. Morgan Spencer, Mr. Thomas Johnson to come forward, I'd appreciate that. And at this time, Mr. Chair, I would move House File 607.
All right. Representative Ellison moves House File 607 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register now. All right, go ahead, Representative Ellison.
Shall I begin, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, House File 607 is a bill that would change current law to allow people who are ex-offenders of felony offenses to vote at the end of their confinement. At this time in Minnesota, one can vote at the end of their probation and parole, and what this bill would do is as soon as they are on the street, so to speak, or out in the community, they would be permitted to vote. Mr. Chair, I'd like you and all the committee members to know that the history of our great country has been one of expanding voting rights. In the beginning of our nation, only propertied, wealthy white men could vote. As time went by, property requirements were dropped and all white men could vote. With the 15th Amendment to the Constitution, all men could vote. We had universal male suffrage. And with the 19th Amendment, we had universal adult suffrage, men and women being allowed to vote. And then, Mr. Chair, it didn't stop there. In 1970, the right to vote was extended to people as young as 18 years old. And so the right to vote in our democracy has been something that has been expanding, not retracting, except for when it comes to people in the condition that this bill addresses. Mr. Chair, I want you to note that people who are in the community who are prior offenders are impacted by law as much as anybody else. They have to feed their families. They have to abide by law. And in fact, when they're on probation and parole, we are trying to get them to reintegrate themselves into society. And in fact, it is in the interest of everyone, every person in our society, that when people leave a correctional institution that they be successful, because otherwise they would be unsuccessful and be recidivists. And one way to encourage them to be successful on reentry is to say that you now can participate in our democratic process. So I'd like you to know, and I'd like the members of our committee to know, that there are at least 15 states who do what this House File 607 is proposing, and so we would not in any way be amongst the cutting edge. There's a number of states that do that, and I believe that there are some handouts that clearly indicate that what the grid and breakdown is. And so I would encourage members to read this all very carefully, because in fact there is quite a bit of information to support House File 607. And I want to just say before I pass it on to the first testifier is that there is no correctional benefit to disenfranchising this category of individuals. It doesn't make us safer at all. In fact, it may lend itself to alienation of certain categories, which would not serve our community well. There's no correctional benefit or purpose to a disenfranchisement. So the person to I'm going to call upon first to testify is going to be Mr. Dwayne Reed of the Minneapolis NAACP. He does have a time restriction, so he's asked to go first. Mr. Reed?
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Reed, please introduce
yourself. Thank you, Chair Johnson, committee members. Good afternoon. First of all, let me start out before I read my prepared remarks by saying that I'm appearing here today, one, in the spirit of nonpartisanship. This has nothing to do with partisanship whatsoever.
Mr. Reed, I'm sorry, just for the record, could you introduce yourself and your organization?
Dwayne K. Reed, NAACP, Minneapolis Branch President.
Thank you.
Again, good afternoon. Thank you again for inviting me or affording me the opportunity to testify on the matter that affects the quality of life for all people in our state, specifically African Americans. I've been in front of this committee last week, and I don't know if I should get a room down here or not, but it's kind of an unusual experience testifying same committee, same faces within a week period. I think it was last Monday. It is important to recognize that ex-defenders are a part of our community once they have done their time. If we don't transition these ex-offenders into the mainstream as soon as possible, we lose the opportunity to rehabilitate and incorporate human beings into a society in which they have to live. Given that the ex-offender the opportunity to participate will do two things. One, it will give them an opportunity to register and be a participant in a jury pool. As you all know, many people who go into the criminal justice system, as far as people of color in this state and in this community, are always saying they don't have a pool of a jury of their peers. And number two, and probably most important, is that it gives them an opportunity to participate in the process of voting. I've been had the experience with many ex-offenders who have called and visited with me at the NAACP to help them on several issues, but one thing sticks in my mind is that the advice and hope that I might give them in this world does not allow them as human beings to exercise their basic right to vote upon their release. And that only happens if you folks would recognize House File 607 as what it is. It's a human being's right to participate. Please allow our members of the community access to the passport to true freedom by giving them restoration and allowing them to pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of all of our happiness. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll take any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Reed. I think maybe we'll go through all the testifiers and then open it up to representatives.
Thank you, Mr. Reed. At this time, I'd ask Mr. Tom Johnson for the Center of Crime and Justice to come forward. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Johnson. I'm president of the Council on Crime and Justice. The Council on Crime and Justice is an independent nonprofit that's been in existence for about 50 years. Our mission is to address the causes and consequences of crime and violence in our society through research, demonstration, and advocacy. The Council is supportive of the legislation that Representative Ellison has before you. And let me go through the reasons. Well, first of all, if you haven't looked at the handout that details where the states lie, you might want to do that, because if Minnesota were to pass this legislation, it would be joining the following states in terms of allowing felons to vote so long as they are, or persons who have been convicted of a felony to vote so long as they're not incarcerated. The states that now allow that include Hawaii, Idaho, Illinois, Indiana, Louisiana, Massachusetts, Michigan, Montana, New Hampshire, North Dakota, Ohio, Oregon, Pennsylvania, and Utah, along with the District of Columbia. Those are the states that currently allow individuals convicted of a felony to vote if they are in the community. Now let me talk about the reasons why the Council on Crime and Justice is supportive. First, it's good public policy, good public safety policy to have individuals who are expected to live law-abiding lives, have a job, take care of their family, pay taxes, to have a stake in the community. Those are all responsibilities. That along with those responsibilities should come the right to vote. And along with that right comes an attachment or reconnection with the community that is important to stabilize the individual and to lower the rate of recidivism. You, I believe, should have received at the beginning of this hearing a resolution that was just recently passed by the American Correctional Association at their annual meeting, supportive of returning the right to vote to people upon their release from prison so that they have the reconnection to the community and a better chance of a successful reentry, that is, without committing additional crime. So this is good public safety policy, reason one. Reason two, we know that the current system is one that, I don't know if it's fair to say it's broken, but it is very flawed. We know that from a number of different perspectives. We know it from the perspective of the Minneapolis Foundation, having funded a study a couple of years ago looking at the existing system, finding significant gaps in the way individuals are disenfranchised in the first place, and then secondly, how they are re-enfranchised or whether they are re-enfranchised at the appropriate time and whether they learn, in fact, that they have been re-enfranchised and therefore have the right to vote. This past fall, the Council on Crime and Justice, along with a number of other organizations, tried to reach out into the community and have it with a public education campaign around the fact that once a person's rights, civil rights are restored, which means nothing, I can tell you, to even most lawyers, much less to an individual who may have not gone to college, much less law school. What we tried to do was tell individuals in Minnesota at the current time, you are eligible to vote once you're off paper. There was incident after incident of individuals who were unaware that they were eligible to vote. In fact, one person called saying, after reading an article in the paper, and said, are you sure that's right? I can vote. If I'm no longer on paper, I can vote. Yes, that's right, that's right. Well, it turns out this person had gone off paper in 1970 and had not voted for the last 34 years, thinking that they were ineligible to vote because they had had a felony conviction. We also know that there are some, within the current system, some significant racial implications. In Minnesota, if you're an African-American, you're 10 times more likely to be disenfranchised under the current law than if you're Caucasian. That's not right. That's not right. We also know that under the existing law, it is possible that a person who has committed a more serious crime can regain the right to vote sooner than a person who has committed a less serious crime. And that's simply an inconsistency or an anachronism within our current law. But someone who commits a serious felony, goes to prison, gets out of prison, say, after 3 years, they're going to be eligible to vote within a year. 4 years ineligible to vote. A person who is convicted of a less serious crime, but a felony, may be on probation for 5 or 10 years and have their right to vote removed for a longer period of time. That's not right. We also know that through some research surveying work that was done by a professor at the university, Christopher Uggins, that the public is supportive of returning the right to vote to people once they are within the community and expected to have all of the responsibilities of a person living within the community. Professor Uggams found that 68% of the public supports returning the right to vote at that point in time. Finally, this is a piece of legislation that doesn't cost you a dime to pass, nor does it cost a dime to implement. In fact, there may be significant savings because we will eliminate the bureaucracy that now exists at the county and state level that is responsible for disenfranchising people once they've been convicted of a felony and re-enfranchising them once they've gone off paper. So not only is this legislation without cost, there is a cost savings that's included. So for those reasons, Mr. Chair and members of the Committee, the Council on Climate Justice is supporting.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, now Commissioner Peter McLaughlin will have some remarks.
Okay. Mr. McLaughlin. Can I just add, I know you have a few others, but maybe if we could keep our testimony relatively short since we have three other bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I will do that. I'm Peter McLaughlin. I'm a member of the Hennepin County Board of Commissioners. The Hennepin County Board supports this legislation. It comes on the heels of two efforts that were initiated by the Hennepin County Board in conjunction with the community, the African American Men Project, which recommended adoption of this legislation, and then a disenfranchisement task force, which was trying to be consistency in the implementation of current laws. City Councilmember Don Samuels is here in the audience. City Councilmember Natalie Johnson Lee asked me to also indicate that she would have been here, but for another meeting that she has back in the city of Minneapolis. We support this legislation for several reasons. First and foremost, we believe that reenfranchisement should be an integral part of the convicted felon's reentry into the community. We supervise thousands of felons as a part of our probation activities. This bill, the change proposed in this bill, would reinstate the right to vote, and by doing so, it would be consistent with existing state policy, which states, and I'll quote, "It is the policy of the state of Minnesota to encourage and contribute to the rehabilitation of criminal offenders and to assist them in the resumption of responsibilities of citizenship." That's existing law. By changing this, by this bill would make participation in the life of the community possible for felons who are still on paper. Voting and citizenship should go hand in hand. This legislation would allow that to happen. Second, we think it would ease administration of elections. This is a little more of a detailed point, but the county, again, is responsible for election implementation and administration. There's a heavy burden that's put on election judges right now. In our state's more than 4,000 precincts. This would make it clear that anyone not incarcerated but still on supervised release would have the right to vote. So there's no confusion about an ex-felon on paper showing up to vote and whether he or she could vote or not. This would end that ambiguity, which we think is a good thing. It would also eliminate a number of communications and administrative burdens for both the courts and the Secretary of State. So for those reasons, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Hennepin County Board supports this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, I do have two other testifiers, and they both, you know that we'd want to be on. All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, next, Mrs. Mary Gaines.
Hi, Ms. Gaines, could you introduce yourself for the
record? Yes, Mary Gaines, director and founder of Federal Forum Faith-Based Call, and I'm also an ex-offender, a person who came out of the federal prison system, now going on 10 years. I finally was able to vote at this last election, which was just not too many months ago. But the reason why I'm here is on behalf of many other people that are sitting in the audience right now. We really need our right to vote. It is about restoration of rights to vote. You have to restore those rights back to us. We come back into this community. We have to be engaged back into the community after you've gone so long. I spent 8 years in the prison system, first time offender. I don't have to go into what the crime was about, but it was a mistake. And I can ask how many people here have made a mistake in their life. If I ask you to raise your hand, I'm sure everyone will raise their hand. But I came back along with many others, and we have even pulled together as ex-offenders to work with people in the community just to have services for ourselves, for employment, to be supported with one another. The other piece was to have public policy so that we can be engaged in voting. That's where we got with Tom Johnson with Council for Crime and Justice. We really need this. It will cost you much more money if you do not restore our voting votes, because of the fact when people do not feel engaged in this community, because it's not just your community, it is ours. My children live here. My children go to school here. My grandchildren go to school here. If we are not engaged in this community, how can we make a living here? How can we be involved here? How can we become a productive community person here? The only way we can do that is if you allow us the chance to come and restore our votes back. So I'm asking that plea as an ex-offender here today, and I'm sure it's thousands who will follow me. So if you will really consider, because your job is not done yet, it may be my vote that can get you back in office.
Thank you, Ms. Haynes.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
I plan to. My name is Cheryl Morgan Spencer, and I am here today on behalf of the Minneapolis Urban League and at the request of our president and CEO, Clarence Hightower. And I have a prepared statement, and I'd like to read the whole thing. It will take 2 minutes, so here we go. I am here to provide testimony in support of House File Number 607, and I bring you greetings from North Minneapolis, but what I have to say, I say on behalf of all Americans, black or white or brown or yellow in this country, who find themselves outside of the essence of democracy. People who do not or cannot participate in the basic right of all Americans, and that is voting. Part of what I do at the Minneapolis Urban League is to work on Get Out the Vote efforts. And over the last several years, and last year in particular, during our voter registration efforts, I met many convicted felons who were off paper, meaning that they had completed their sentence, and still did not know, as has been attested before, that in the state of Minnesota, they could vote. And I just want you to know that words are inadequate to describe the hope that I saw reflected in the eyes of these people, men and women, white people and black, who learned that they could vote, that once again they were considered worthy citizens. If a person believes that they can become a part of something that is good, a proud American citizen, even if they have been a convicted felon, if they paid their dues, and if they believe they can turn their lives around, if they can participate in the political making of our great country, then we will truly have something that is needed so desperately in America, and that is real civic rehabilitation. And it is needed everywhere, everywhere in our great nation, people participating in the political life of this country. We have to change the way that we look at people who have been incarcerated. Is everybody listening to me? I just want to make sure that everybody's listening. We have to change the way that we look at people who have been incarcerated. After all, we are talking about a lot of people. We cannot become a nation that ends up consuming itself because we keep locking people up. We cannot continue to just lock up people and throw away whole lives. People who are cynical about America because the laws that work for you don't work for them. We cannot afford it. The world is changing all around us. We must have the talent and the hope of rehabilitated people working with the system and not against it. This country can no longer afford all of the ways in which it keeps oppression going. Let's just be frank about it. One consequence of oppression is ambivalence. We don't need ambivalence, not today. Ambivalence will not allow us to maintain our status as the greatest country in the world. The rest of the world is truly watching us. We need citizens who care about this country, who want to vote, and we have to use everything we have to motivate those people, even if they were once convicted felons. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Morgan Spencer.
Mr. Chair, that concludes the testifiers. I would like the committee to know that several members of the community have come down to watch the proceedings today, and I just want to let them know that we know that they're here and appreciate them coming down.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I think that we could stand for a few questions at this time. If the committee has any.
Sure. Other questions or discussion on the bill? Representative Emmer.
Representative Ellison, and all the folks that have testified, I do appreciate your remarks, but I do have some concerns about the proposed legislation. For starters, Representative Ellison, the same argument, I can see it being made for someone who's been convicted of a felony and would like to have a permit to carry a firearm. It's basically the same argument about, with all due respect to the folks who have testified about the right to vote somehow engages folks in society. I think it's a very important right. And again, there's certain circumstances. I don't know if this bill addresses it. I would agree. But the problem I'm having with the proposed legislation is while someone is on supervised release or is on probation, they automatically have the right to vote. And I just kept coming into my head about the same argument can come back on the firearms, the right to drive. These are privileges. They're not rights. And under the 14th Amendment, it gives the state the right to do this when someone has violated the laws, whether you think they work for people or not. That is what the Constitution provides. I would just ask, how would you respond to that?
Mr. Chair, I'm glad you asked that question. In fact, an excellent question, Representative Emmer, because I think that one of the things that we're saying, and I'm trying to say, is that wherein the public safety issue is concerned, wherever a measure would improve safety of the public, we would not want to change that. So, for instance, if an ex-offender, by virtue of their conviction, were deprived of the right to handle a firearm, I would not support that because firearms are inherently dangerous and could cause someone loss of life. Driving also can be an inherently dangerous activity for somebody who's demonstrated that they're not fit to operate a motor automobile safely. But in the case of voting, it is not an inherently dangerous activity. In fact, there's no public safety process, goal to be served because the act of voting will not risk life, property, or anything like that. It's an inherently safe activity and so that's sort of how we draw the line.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you. And thanks for that response. But while you were speaking, so does that mean that you would not, under your proposed bill, and this is a multi-part, I'll ask two of them. One, you don't make any distinction between reoffending. In other words, you could have somebody who gets incarcerated and released and incarcerated and released, incarcerated and released. You go on ad nauseum. The first one is, do you have a limit where the state should be able to restrict that right? And second, if you're the prosecuting attorney, would you agree that a person that's been through this experience once or more than once should be on your jury pool?
Well, Mr. Chair, to the serial offender, that person under our bill would be deprived of the right to vote while they were confined. And our goal, Commissioner McLaughlin said, when someone is released, all of us, every one of us, has an interest in making sure that they successfully reenter. So this should be looked upon as partially a way to help reengage that person who has violated our democratically promulgated laws. So that's how I see that issue, the serial offender. That person, we're going to continually try to make them obey the law. If they don't, they go back in. And again, they're going to be going back in for longer and longer periods of time because of our sentencing scheme. As it relates to being a prosecutor, you can have a for-cause challenge or a peremptory challenge on any juror whatsoever. If a juror says that I have a prior conviction, I'm off paper, or then you can say, well, you know what, thank you, sir, but I'm going to excuse you from this jury. And folks like you and I do that all the time.
And so I don't think that a prosecutor is going to be required to have somebody who's an ex-offender. But I tell you this, I've tried a lot of cases in my day. Up until I got into the legislature, I tried about 6 cases to a jury every year for about 15 years. And there were people on my juries who had prior convictions. And sad to say, they didn't always see it the way I saw it. But the question was inclusion, reintegration. So those are just a few responses that I would have to those excellent questions. Are we running out of time now, Mr. Chair?
We have 4 questioners left, Representative Ellison. I would like to stop shortly since we have 3 more bills, but we could try to get through these quickly. We had talked about possibly laying this on the table, which is what I think I will do. Well, why don't we go ahead and try to get through these 4 questioners, and we'll try to keep our answers short. Representative DeLaForest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try to keep you. Representative Ellison, I'm trying to get clear in my mind exactly who this would apply to. As you know, being trained in the law, we have malum prohibitum type of crimes and malum in se type of crimes, and I'm concerned as we continue to expand sort of the malum prohibitum type of crimes, and I can understand restoring votes, but are we also talking about the malum in se type of people, the worst of the worst that we've talked about? Would they also be eligible for restored rights earlier under your proposal?
Mr. Chair, those individuals, Representative Forrest, are going to be prohibited from voting during the period of their confinement. Those individuals that you're referring to, the worst of the worst, a lot of them are serving life sentences or very, very long sentences anyway. A first-degree murderer in the state of Minnesota is not even eligible for parole for 30 years. Certain individuals serving sentences for serious sex offenses are serving double and triple decade sentences. So I think the worst of the worst would not ever get eligible because most of them are going to be in prison for the rest of their lives.
Perhaps we have a difference of opinion because I know, for example, we talk about sex offenders who, of course, are on supervised release. And it leads me to the second question, Representative Ellison. I believe in the concept of rehabilitation. I believe in the concept of redemption. I certainly believe in that. But, you know, given, you know, for a variety of reasons we can't explore today, certainly would you agree with me that there are those in the criminal justice system who are outside the walls of a prison but still under the supervision of the criminal justice system who still pose a threat? I mean, there's a reason why folks aren't absolutely released. And so maybe this is a comment more than a question, that I have concerns that we would be restoring the right to vote to folks who still, in the judgment of society, pose a potential threat to society.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say briefly, those people would have to make every probation meeting. They would have to give urine samples as often as required. They would be subject to curfew. They would be required to random testing of any kind. They would be required to follow a treatment plan, which could include treatment for sex offender, drug offender, whatever, gambling addiction, whatever. They would not get one pass as it relates to what's required to them of the criminal justice system in the state of Minnesota. The only thing those people who are in the community could do under my bill is cast a vote. And if they were not, and so that, therein, we're not giving them a pass in any way, shape, or form. If they don't show up at a probation meeting, revoked. If they don't pass the urine analysis, potential revoked. So if they reoffend, absolutely revoked. So there is the level of accountability that does help the public safety will still be very much in place.
Mr. Chairman, just one more quick follow-up, please. Representative Ellison, it's interesting, there are states that do subscribe to your proposed bill. It is law for them. Is there any empirical data out there, any scholarly data which would support your theory and actually try and imply sort of a quantitative or qualitative analysis to say that restoring the right to vote at the point at which you would provide it actually does help offenders reintegrate?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that question, and I will research it. I think it's a good question, and I'd actually like to know it myself, but I can't say that I know it. Maybe somebody here knows the answer definitively.
So the National Institute of Corrections, there's data that states that when a person have their voting rights, not just the voting rights, but being able to come back into the community, education, and voting rights, they have shown that those are the people who remain law body.
I'm sorry. I have Representative Dean Nelson left, and then we will lay this on the table. Representative Dean.
Oh, goodness. Does it work? Oh, I don't have to pay for it. Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Elson. I just had a question, and maybe this is contained somewhat in some of the terms that I don't understand, not being familiar with the correctional system much as some others here, but just a personal circumstance. A friend of mine was convicted of a federal crime and was placed in a federal correctional facility and was released a year early, but he had a bracelet that he had to wear on his ankle and was very, very restricted basically to his property for the period of, I believe, at least a year. So under this, I would assume that he would be allowed to leave his property to vote, if I'm understanding this correctly. I'm wondering also if he would be allowed to leave property to engage in other sorts of civic debates, so for example, candidate debates or public forums, or if this would be prescribed specifically to that, or just how would that affect a person like him?
Mr. Chair, another good question. Any person in the community but under supervision would have to comply with whatever the correctional authority said they had to do. So if that person's probation officer said they can get out and vote, they could. They have to say when they were leaving, when they're coming back, and they'd be under very tight controls with that bracelet. But this bill does not open the door any wider than just voting, casting a vote. If you don't have any more, this bill does not give any offender permission to do anything at all that their PO does not allow them to do.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And kind of following up on Representative DeForest, I think I understood, and I could have been wrong, Mr. Johnson stated that it would lower the rate of the recidivism, and so then my question is, you know, does Maine and Vermont have a lower recidivism rate, or what is there compared to Minnesota's? And then I do have a follow-up, just a comment.
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure what the answer to that question is. I can look at that and get back to you, but I offhand do not know what the recidivism rate is. And I know what the recidivism rate is as a general principle coming out of prison nationally, but I don't know what it is for those two states and how it compares to the Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, I should say this for Representative Nelson and the committee. Maine and Vermont are among the lowest crime states in the United States and have the lowest rates of incarceration. Minnesota also has a very low rate of incarceration for the general population. Mm-hmm. But Maine and Vermont are among the very lowest crime states in our union.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Allison for answering that. To Ms. Spencer, talking about people that, many people that were off paper didn't even realize it, that they had the right to vote. And to that, I would say probably a big shame on you, to all of us, for not getting that information to them. And I think somebody gave an example of somebody that's been off paper for 30 years plus. And that is a separate case. This change won't do anything on that, and we better do a whole lot better job of getting that information to them. And as far as her statement that we need to change how we incarcerate our people, I think that I agree with that. I know I agree with it. Getting out the information is part of it. But we already are with programs like the IFI, which certainly has proven to reduce the recidivism rate on the Minnesota prison population greatly, from something near 55% to something closer to 8.5%. And I think that my personal philosophy is that, and I've said it for a long time, that we need to either change the term from the Department of Corrections to the Department of Prisons, or else we need more programs like the IFI that really do count to reduce the recidivism rate. And that was more comments than question, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the time.
Last question, Representative Lex.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and testifiers. More a comment than a question. I will also say in response to
Representative Emmer asked about on jury pools of how we end up with folks. And I've been in that position as a prosecutor, having to go through lists of folks who've had prior convictions for felonies or whatever, sitting on my jury pool, and it's an issue that I have. But in Minnesota, we draw from the voting lists and driver's license records too, so we end up with those lists regardless of whether they have they're precluded from voting. But I guess I would say, as a prosecutor, I don't think there are too many other folks who sit on this committee who have been in a position of knocking on the door in their district and facing an individual that they put behind bars. And that's happened to me at least half a dozen times. And three of them took lawn signs, actually. and it wasn't because I was that fair either. I just, you know, I thought I did my job. But the fact is, I really believe that this issue of recidivism or getting out of jail is more a gray issue. Representative De La Forest brought the issue up of malum in se crimes, and I think it comes down to, these are gray areas. These are people we are trying to put back into society and make productive members. I see every day, whether it's in court or whether it's knocking on doors, these people who want to be productive members, and some of the most productive members of society I've seen have been these constituents of mine who I work with, who have done time in federal and state prisons, but who are trying to be the role models for the children in their neighborhoods today. So I would hope that, I think this bill does that. I think this bill gets towards putting these people back into productive positions in society sooner rather than later. I think that would do the best thing we can to reducing recidivism. Thanks a lot. I appreciate you bringing the bill forward.
Thank you, Representative Less. Any closing statements, Representative Ellison?
Only this, Mr. Chair. I do sincerely appreciate you allowing us to have the bill heard today. That I appreciate it a lot. This bill was in committee for the Government Ops Committee last year. The elections was in Government Operations last time, and it did actually pass through committee. I want to thank all the testifiers who came and all the excellent questions that were asked. Mr. Chair, I am going to ask you to lay the bill over, that will conclude.
All right, thank you. I will lay over House File 607. Thank you all for being here. Next bill is House File 680, Representative De La Forest. Representative De La Forest, before you move your bill, we have two other bills after this. One probably will not take long. One may take a bit of time. So I'd like to keep this relatively short. We have several people who want to testify in opposition, and I think I'll ask them to, I'll probably limit their testimony as well. So if you'd like to move your bill.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members. For the record, Representative De La Forest, District 49A. Mr. Chairman and members, I would move that House File 680 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Financial Institutions.
All right. And did you have any amendments of your own?
No, Mr. Chairman.
All right, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Be respectful of the committee. Where's everybody going? And this is unfortunately part of the mundane aspect of today's agenda compared to the cheeseburger bill and Representative Ellison's bill. To be brief, Mr. Chairman, what this bill does is it makes a couple of changes primarily to current landlord-tenant law. Right now, one of the changes that is proposed in my bill is to allow a lessee who has an apartment, say, that is metered individually to that apartment. There may be a situation where part of that individual's unit may be wired to a common area. The primary example is where an apartment dweller has a light out in the hallway into the common area. Under that scenario, under current law, the law says that the lessee must be the customer of record for the utility. The proposed change would simply say that, that the landlord would be the customer of record. The proposed change is, with proper and due written notice, the lessee can be the customer of record, despite the fact that there may be a wire running out to the common area. Second, in looking at the bill, it also speaks to refunds that may be due if the proper notice is not given regarding metering to the common areas. The third change that the bill speaks here, Mr. Chairman and members, is it specifies exactly what kind of fees can be collected by a landlord with respect to administering these utilities. Right now,
this is a gray area and the law is silent on it, and so there is a mixed practice out there where we frankly don't know exactly how these things are being charged to the tenants, and we're fairly sure that the tenants don't have knowledge of the way this is happening. So from a public policy perspective, what this bill aims to do is a couple things. First of all, give some notice and disclosure in writing to lessees who might not be getting this kind of notice and disclosure. And second, regulate the type of fees that a landlord may be able to charge. Because as I mentioned right now, the statute is silent with respect to that state of affairs. And so we may have tenants out there who are getting charged and not knowing it. And not only that, there's no regulation as to what may be charged on the part of the landlord. Mr. Chairman, if you'd like, I can turn things over to Mr. Horner, who is aware of the committee's time as well, but may have some brief comments as well.
Mr. Horner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jack Horner, representing the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Thank you, Representative. The bill is before you, and you understand the bill. I just have a couple of comments. This is an important bill for those of us, landlords and tenants alike, energy folks, folks involved in apportioning out these bills. There's a number of issues that need clarification and resolution, and this bill does that in a fair and even-handed manner. And a lot of these issues have come to the forefront just over the last couple of years, particularly in light of a PUC XL tariff that imposes very severe penalties on landlords, even for technical violations. In the audience, who I'm not calling up but invite to any questions that there may be, is Mr. John Hager of St. Paul. 15 years ago, prior to the passage of the underlying law that we're amending, Mr. Hager had his duplexes all rehabbed. And they kept, as is common and reasonable, they kept the basement kind of divided between the meters and the two tenants and the front light and the back light. Kind of a reasonable solution. And yet, when that was discovered, Mr. Hager ended up paying some $1,600 in penalties plus $1,000 attorney's fee simply because it was a technical violation, even though the tenants were perfectly satisfied with this arrangement and it would serve to the benefit of the tenants. Other landlords who are here who are willing to answer questions have a situation in which there's a hallway light in a large apartment building, for example, that's wired into the unit so that a tenant is now paying for the electric in his unit and for the light in the hallway. Again, technically a shared meter, technically the landlord should be the customer of record, and yet it's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. The alternative is that the landlord would be required to be the customer, and now he can then rebuild the tenant, which is not a very reasonable thing to do with expense and time, or rewire the building, which again is expensive and like all costs ultimately are passed on, have to be passed on, or can simply build it into the rent. It's kind of an unspecified charge. Another situation, Mr. Ted Retchick, who asked me to tell you his story. You've got a little map there that he drew. I bring it to your attention just because it's a situation in which landlords and tenants ought to be free to contract knowingly between themselves in this area. Mr. Retchick has a farm in the Wabasha-Mazeppa area. He rented the house and some of the acreage to tenant Wendy Smith. She, in turn, supplied water and electric light to a barn across the road. You can see the map he drew kind of roughly there. Went to another person who is not even a tenant. That person has 15 or 20 horses that Mr. Retchick allows him to put in the barn. And so in return for his kind of looking over the property, pays no rent, the electric and the water is allowed to go, technically, according to Excel, a shared meter situation. And Mr. Retchick ended up paying over $1,000 simply because he had let this other person, the horse owner, use some electric and water that Wendy Smith had the meter on. And that even though it was fully disclosed, even though the two parties had reached an agreement on the payment back and forth, it seemed that it should be allowed and that there should not be a penalty for this kind of a thing. This bill allows transparency. It allows the landlords and tenants to know what they're getting into and to negotiate. The second part of the bill clarifies that certain fees may be passed on through. It's a fair bill in that it
says that a landlord cannot charge any more than the aggregate of his utility bills. He is allowed to pass certain fees through. Current statute is silent on this topic. This law would allow those fees to be passed through with full disclosure and with capping the fees. Finally, Mr. Chairman, you have before you a handout showing the representative charges for some various companies. There are some 50 companies in the country that do this third-party billing that will bill and collect these fees and provide this service. A lot of competition in this area. This list is some of the ones that we know of in the state of Minnesota. The general industry average monthly administration fee, as you can see, is about $3.25. This is according to AUM, which is a large company that does business in Minnesota. Others proceed on. You can see for yourself. They're self-explanatory. They're all across the board, but they're all small as to what they charge. And then we show, just for example, what CenterPoint Energy and Xcel have as their basic charge and what their charges are. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Horner. Question from Representative Tilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I had a question. I was assuming when I looked at this bill before we heard it that it would be referred to the Committee on Regulated Industries.
Could Representative Hilke, that may be the case. Chairman Wilkin had requested in Commerce first, so my guess is it may go there thereafter.
That's correct, Chairman Johnson. It's a fact. Representative Wilkin did ask to see the bill next, and I have not heard from the chair of the Regulated Industries Committee yet, Ms. Representative Hilke.
All right, I have... I'm sorry, Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Horner, real quick question for you, because we had a discussion a few weeks ago, and I told you, from the standpoint of a landlord, it makes sense to me that the landlord should be reimbursed by his or her tenants for their use of the property, including a fair share for use of, for instance, a light in a common area. In reading your bill, I have a question for you, or the bill that Representative De La Forest is authoring. I have a question for you, Mr. Horner. Let's say you got a multi-unit apartment house, and you've apportioned the utility use, the common area utility use, amongst the actual living units. What happens under your bill if one of those units or several of those units are empty? In other words, nobody's living in them. Under your bill, would that allow the landlord then to reapportion the common area costs to the units that are actually occupied?
Mr. Horner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer, excellent question. The statute is silent on that topic. It may be that we need some further legislation. We've resolved some of the issues. At the moment, the answer to your question is that a landlord could indeed take the bill that he gets, the total bill, and simply divide it among the units, the occupied units. In practice, the landlords that I know, and I'm quite confident that the common practice would be to make a deduction for those units that are not occupied, and it would depend on the utility. If it's electric or water, dividing the meter among the existing properties is probably fair. If it's heat, one might argue, well, the building had to be heated anyway, and so maybe there should be a deduction. In other words, maybe the landlord should absorb the charge for heating the vacant unit, since you would have to heat it anyway. But in any case, at the moment the law is silent, but it is my belief that you could take the utility bill and simply apportion it out among the existing tenants.
Representative Emmer?
I'm sorry, we don't have any time.
If you can ask a follow-up quickly.
Well, just first a comment that the law is intended for people who aren't going to be the good ones. But the question I've got is, let's say there's a dispute. Who do you anticipate is going to resolve that dispute?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really appreciate that. It gets to the heart of at least some of the concern about the bill. I do want to stress that the purpose of this bill and the reason, for example, that it's in landlord-tenant law is that it regulates the conduct of landlords and tenants. Currently, under a PUC tariff, an XL tariff, a collapsible only to XL, but a tariff approved by the PUC, XL is the policeman and the investigator of some of these shared meter situations. I've been at numerous meetings with them, and they have strongly said they don't want to be the policeman, the investigator. They're not equipped for it, and I agree. And so one of the purposes of this bill is to get make sure that XL, for example, would not be required to arbitrate disputes or to resolve landlord-tenant issues. It's a contractual issue between landlord and tenant. It's been suggested to me that there may need some additional language to make that absolutely clear, although it seems to me that it is already, because it is in landlord-tenant law after all, and we've indicated our strong willingness to add whatever language is necessary to make it absolutely clear that we're talking about a relationship between landlord and tenant.
Thank you, Mr. Horner. I have six people who are scheduled to testify, I believe, in opposition to the bill, first being Mr. Bernberg, if you would come forward. And we took just a little under 15 minutes to present the bill and have testimony in favor. I'd like to limit the testimony against to 15 minutes, so we will stop at just before 10-2. So if we could keep the testimony just to 2 or 3 minutes, that would be very helpful. Mr. Bernberg, if you could introduce yourself to the record, please.
Good afternoon, committee members and Chairman Johnson. My name is Paul Bernberg. I am the senior housing attorney with HomeLine. Senior housing attorney means probably that I'm the oldest, if not the longest there. Mr. Johnson is familiar with me since I used to be on my board. Briefly, HomeLine is a nonprofit tenant advocacy agency. We do some tenant organizing, some tenant side litigation. But I think our signature division is a hotline to answer tenants' questions throughout the state, including an 800 number about landlord-tenant law and maintaining a database when we get back to tenants, etc. We've received hundreds, not quite thousands, but hundreds of calls regarding shared meters. I end up taking most of the calls because I'm kind of become the in-house expert on the subject. And I can tell you, either none or very few of those calls are about the single light bulb problem. That's not what people call. They call us when they get a bill that's 2 or 3 times higher than they expect, have looked into it and found out that there's a shared meter. It can be electric, it can be water, it can even be gas, heat. They discovered they're paying the heat for the electric on 2 units in a triplet. They're paying the heat or electric for a garage in their unit. They're paying their own unit in the laundry room. That means sometimes the electric, sometimes the gas can power the washer and dryer, sometimes both. They're paying for the parking lot in the unit. They're paying for the landlord's construction crew, because the construction crew is using an outlet that happens to be hooked up to their electric meter. And these are not these little tiny light bulbs in the hallway problems, which probably could be fixed by the PUC. These are major bills that the tenant ends up getting on his own bill. The history of this is, I think Mr. Horner somewhat hinted at, and Representative LaFarge, prior to 1995, there was no protection for tenants. In 95, this legislature, signed by the governor, passed the law, Chapter 192, that said if you got a shared meter, a single meter, it's got to be the landlord's name and the landlord pays the bill. Promotes conservation and it keeps out of the tenant the burden of paying the bill that unfairly saddles the tenant with his bill and bills outside his control, including the landlord. Then in 2000, or 1999, 2000, passed in 2000, the landlords came to this legislature and said, we want to do the following. We want to be able to take a bill, we'll keep it in our own name, and we will rebuild the tenants by a formula that estimates their use and makes the tenants as a group pay for the tenants' group usage, so that way the tenants will hold down their usage. Not the landlord's usage. Not things out of the tenant's control, but if we get to rebuild the tenant for the tenant's usage, maybe they can hold down their usage. Now, there's been disagreement about that, and I'm not so sure it's a great theory, but that was the landlord's theory when they came and convinced this legislature to pass what's now the law, leaving the landlord three choices. Individually meter, which can promote conservation the best way. Keep it in his own name,
just including the rent, just like he figures the mortgage and other things he figures his bill. Or lastly, let's say you do have a shared meter. Electric meter measures the laundry room and the tenant's own usage. You figure out the tenant's usage, laundry room usage, let's say it's $30 a month. You say to the tenant in the bill, in the lease, your bill is going to be the total bill minus $30 a month. That's your fair usage. If you use too much, it's going to go up, go down less. But it's not going to kick the tenant with the laundry bill and double or triple something that's outside his control. It's whether his neighbors use the laundry or the landlord fix the laundry. So those are three choices. There was actually, of course, a fourth choice the landlord had. They could disobey the law and hope they got away with it. And if they got caught, what would happen? Well, they'd be rebilled in a relatively large bill for all the usage that they should have been paying in little bits all along. In other words, they weren't hit with some kind of penalty bill. They were just hit with a bill that they got away with paying for years in one bill. In effect, the tenants were loaning the money for time, and then they pay it all back. So in summary, this bill, I think other people in opposition are going to talk about these administrative charges, but the bill allows tenants to be billed for the privilege of getting billed. Secondly, it rewards landlords who disobeyed the law in the past. And lastly, it allows the tenants who doesn't have any negotiating power. These are residential tenants. There's just no negotiating power. It allows the landlord to stick the tenant, unbeknownst essentially until the end of it, with paying for all the parking lot lights, heating all the halls, the party room, the rental office, electricity for all the washers and dryers. If the sprinkler system set up to the tenant's water, the sprinkler system. This is just not a good bill at all. It ought to be defeated. Let the PUC deal with the minor problem having to do with a little light bulb outside. They're experts at that. And put this bill away. I thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman. And I'd be happy to take questions or allow the other people, however the chair wishes to proceed. Right.
Thank you, Mr. Bernberg. What I'd like to do is go through the rest of the testifiers, and then we'll open it up to questions.
Should I take my seat back there?
Yeah, that would be great. Pam Marshall is the next person on our list. Ms. Marshall?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I know that others have things to say, so I'm just going to focus on one of the several problems with this bill. First of all, my name is Pam Marshall. I'm director of the Energy Sense Coalition. Our organization represents over 40 organizations that have advocated on behalf of low and fixed income energy consumers for the past 17 years. Before I get to the one point that I'm going to make today, I think we should remember why this bill is before you at all. The fact is, landlords have violated the provisions of this statute that requires them to inform the utility company that they are the bill payer of record when there is a shared meter situation. When that fact is discovered, tenants are reimbursed and landlords are charged for the bill that they should have been paying for all along. So it seems to me one of the purposes of this bill is to limit the refund to tenants and therefore hold landlords less responsible for the energy costs for usage in common areas. And because that's the case, it seems that landlords are seeking monetary relief as a result of violating the law, which seems somewhat backwards to me. But I want to focus primarily on the fees associated with this bill, which is the section that begins on line 3.3. Keep in mind, please, that landlords do not have to bill tenants in single-metered buildings for utility service. They could simply fold the utility costs into rental amounts. So the question I have is, why would landlords voluntarily take on the additional task of billing tenants for utility charges? It seems under this bill that the answer is so that they can charge additional fees. The original apportionment statute did not include fees associated with providing tenants with appropriated utility bills. It's somewhat ironic that landlords charge tenants account activation fees when the whole point of this law is that the utility account should be in the landlord's name. The original single-metered building statute was enacted in order to protect tenants from paying for energy usage that should not have been charged to their individual unit, as you've heard, common lighting, laundry facilities, etc. But this bill undermines the original intention of the single meter building law. It also further undermines the ability of tenants to limit what they will be charged for utility service, independent even of usage. The tenants are now responsible for additional utility service related fees at the same time that they have no utility customer consumer protection. Most of the fees contemplated in this bill are already charged in the provision of utility service to a building, such as billing fees, late payment fees, etc. In other words, the imposition of additional fees increase the tenant's inability to pay for utility costs and at the same time allow landlords to profit from the tenant's inability to pay for utility costs. That's all I have. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Marshall. The next person on my list is Andrea Skimmelhorn from CenterPoint Energy. We have about 6 minutes left for four different testifiers, so you could be brief.
Mr. Chair, I'm Andrea Skimmelhorn from CenterPoint Energy, and I actually did not intend to testify today, so I will, at this point, then allow the next person to testify.
Thank you. Ron Gitek from the Attorney General's Office. Sorry if I'm pronouncing that incorrectly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The office, this is Ron Gitek from the Minnesota Office of the Attorney General, Residential Utilities Division. The Office of the Attorney General is opposed to this bill, particularly because the PUC has been involved in the shared meter issue for several years, with the result being a finding that what this bill would allow landlords to do to tenants is not in the public interest. The PUC has an open docket right now that's taking a look at this very issue, and this bill jumps the gun by effectively gutting the PUC action. The Office of the Attorney General would ask that the legislature afford the PUC the respect and comity it deserves by going forward here. We would short-circuit the due process rights of those that are currently involved in the PUC process. This bill would allow landlords to have tenants pay for utility service to areas outside their apartments if the tenant is notified that the landlord is doing this. However, local ordinances in most cities require landlords to provide common area lighting in hallways and the exterior. Shifting this responsibility to tenants is not appropriate and could actually result in dangerous conditions in these buildings. I mean, you know, if a tenant wanted to unscrew the light in the hall, I mean, it's not the tenant's responsibility to provide the common area lighting. And in terms of this equal bargaining power, I mean, what landlord would countenance a tenant running an extension cord to an outlet that the landlord is paying for a tenant's refrigerator or something like that? I mean, they would be up in arms. Essentially, this is what the landlords want to be able to do with the tenants. They want tenants to pay for usage outside of their area. And in no other commodity I know of is anyone allowed to charge people an estimated bill. It would be like going to the grocery store and coming up to the checkout with your cart and the person say, well, that looks like about $100. I mean, that's how apportionment works. And this just compounds the issue by allowing these third-party billing companies to come in. The Attorney General's office won a case in Anoka County Court where the judge said that these additional fees are not lawful. This would allow these. And additionally, the PUC in the Excel tariff says that a landlord can only pass on what the landlord pays to the tenant, and that would override that. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Tech. Ron Elwood from Legal Aid. And then the last testifier that I have in opposition is Chris Clark from Xcel Energy. Mr. Elwood, welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Actually, what I'd like to do is ask a couple of my colleagues who actually practice in the area and have had experience to give you 2 minutes on the bill. So
that would be wonderful if we can keep it to 2 minutes. Could you please introduce yourself for the record, sir?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Gary Van Winkle. I am the staff lawyer at the Southside Office of the Legal Aid Society of Minneapolis, and I'll try to be as brief and succinct about this as I can be. I am the lead lawyer who brought the civil actions that resulted in the tariff that is troubling the landlords. And I just have to say that this is actually a proposal to repeal tenant protection statute. It's nothing less than that. I have practiced in the area of utility shutoffs since 1990, and I'm impressed by the unequal bargaining power, especially as regards low-income tenants relative to their landlords. And I've got to say that probably hundreds of shutoffs that I have dealt with in my practice, it is palpably unfair when a low-income family is about to be shut off for utility service, in part because they haven't paid for usage they didn't consume. I can't emphasize enough how unfair that is fundamentally. This is not only a tenant-unfriendly bill. This is a consumer-unfriendly bill. I think, as Mr. Gutek alluded to earlier, in all other areas of commerce, virtually every other area where commodities are sold or services are provided, we pay for what we use. And this bill is about having tenants pay for what they don't use. And I think if you are perhaps middle-class or upper-middle-class tenant, where the bargaining power is different and where your financial circumstances are different, maybe that's not so significant a factor, but if you are low income, you rely on energy assistance to meet your seasonal utility needs, that little bit that you're not, or maybe not so little bit, depending on the case, that you're not really using, it just becomes palpably unfair. Let me say also that the Public Utilities Commission tariff is not a penalty provision. It simply, as has been stated previously, it simply rebills the landlord for a shared meter that the landlord should have disclosed under the statute previously and failed to do so. So that is not a penalty provision. There are a couple points that I'd like to make about how this bill is out of step with the current trend of the law and, in fact, is directly contrary to provisions of law. The building code...
If you could wrap up your...
I will. The building code, for example, mandates that new construction includes separately metered units and multi-unit dwellings. I'm losing my train of thought. Let me wrap up. I do have to move on. One of the most counterproductive effects of this bill will be to again put regulated utilities in the position of shutting off tenants for usage that is not their own, which is contrary to relevant utility law. Another aspect of this bill is that it will put tenants in the position of obtaining LIHEAP assistance, which is federal fuel assistance, to pay in part for landlord usage. Allusion has already been made to the loss of lighting perhaps in areas where laundry rooms or common areas have become a tenant's bill. It's become delinquent. It goes dark. It's a safety hazard. Let me just repeat that I think this bill is a consumer and a tenant unfriendly bill, and I ask the committee to reject it.
Thank you, Mr. Van Winkle. And Chris Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify for Xcel Energy today. My name is Chris Clark. I'm an attorney with Xcel Energy. I've worked extensively, actually, with most of the people who just testified before you on this issue. And as you've heard, it is a currently pending docket before the PUC. We do have a tariff as a result of the action that Mr. Van Winkle was speaking of. As a result of the effect of that tariff and some of the issues we've been coming across, we brought the tariff back with a description of different situations that we're encountering so that the PUC can be aware of how that tariff is being applied on a day-to-day basis and make the decision whether they want to make any changes to it. The tariff is, and actually we have been working with parties extensively. One of the issues that we faced, and we opposed the bill, but today we, in its current state, but I think we're okay with the bill as a solution. There are issues in this situation of a shared meter that some parties have claimed without a change to the statute, there's no compromise here. So it may be the best solution to pursue it in the legislative arena, although we're certainly willing to work in front of the PUC. Understand that the PUC was trying to solve an issue here. The issue is that which Mr. Van Winkle described, where tenants are paying for usage that is actually for a common area. They read the statute to be a very technical, bright-line statute, and as a result, essentially apply their billing rules so that when we find these situations, we go in and bill back the landlord for the previous year. This current situation obviously creates a harsh economic result for landlords. For having a light bulb in the hallway or even more serious consequences, the tariff applies a one-year back billing and then a credit, likewise credit, to those tenants. We're concerned for both our landlord and tenant customers. We think we have approximately 60,000 situations where this would occur, and that's a huge number of back billings for landlords, and it's a huge number of credits for tenants. It's also a huge number of situations where any fact scenario can be present. It can be anything from the light bulb in the hallway to washing machines and dryers to complete some of the fact situations you've heard here. The fact situations run the gamut, and that makes it more difficult to solve this issue. The reason we do oppose the bill here today is because it leaves it unclear what our role in it is. We don't want to be in the business of investigating internal wiring of buildings. We take the position that our service should go up to the meter and stop. The landlord really controls the property. The landlord should be responsible for the internal wiring. Likewise, we don't want to be in the business of trying to figure out what exactly is in the common area and what is not in the common area. We don't want to be trying to estimate what the various usages are. Again, it puts us in the position of having to understand the complete internal wiring of the building and then apply a non-metered measurement to what that usage is. It's a very difficult and time-consuming factual inquiry. We don't think we're in the best place to do it, and we think it's expensive for all customers if we're left in that position. And finally, we don't want to be in the position of having to resolve what can be considered a landlord-tenant dispute. We don't want to be in the position of having a landlord or a tenant fax us their lease and say, well, if you'll just read provision 7, you'll see that I've properly notified the tenant. And the tenant then saying, yes, but if you look at provision 9, you'll see that I think provision 9 overrides provision 7. These are issues that more properly belong in front of a court or another authority. We do support a legislative solution to this. We're here to answer questions. I also have with me Pat Boland, who's a supervisor of customer service, who deals with a lot of these customers, both landlords and tenants, when they call with these issues. And look forward to answering any questions the committee might have about this.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Questions for the author or any of the testifiers? Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, I guess my question is this. What would presumably a tenant right now under the current system of law is going to be paying part of their rent for common areas? if they are then assessed additional fees for common areas, is there a danger that they could be getting double billed?
Mr. Clark?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, I believe that there is, and I believe that's some of the concern that the tenants groups have raised with it, with the issue.
Other questions? Representative DeLaForest, anything to wrap up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To be brief, I think what I'll do is take less than a minute here and let Mr. Horner just make a quick few points in defense of this bill, and then I'll just take a brief moment to wrap up. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just a couple of comments on some of the comments that you had heard. First of all, the bill that was passed in 1995, the underlying law that requires the landlord to be the customer, was passed primarily and almost exclusively to solve a situation whereby one tenant was paying a utility bill that included other units. And commonly what would happen in a duplex, for example, is one tenant would be the customer, and then he'd get the bill from the utility company, and then he'd have to collect the other half from the other tenant who may or may not pay, or in the tenant who got the bill may or may not send it in. Obvious room for problems there. And so the testimony that was presented in favor of that bill was almost exclusively to resolve that situation. This bill does not undo that. This bill does not allow one tenant to pay for another tenant's unit. It does not require one tenant to collect a fee from another tenant. It simply says with full written disclosure in advance that a tenant may be required to pay for some common area usage. And what ifs and surmising and all the possible horror stories, the fact is that it's good for the tenants in a duplex. They want the front light on. They want the back light on. There's not a common meter. When new buildings are built, as was stated, they are indeed separately metered. That's the building code. But we've got thousands of units in which it's a very reasonable solution to require that the tenant pay for a bit of the usage. There's no such thing as a tenant not using it or not wanting it. He's not paying for something he doesn't get the value for.
Mr. Horner, could you...
Yeah, okay, thank you. Finally, one other thing that I think should be said is that... Mr. Gutek of the Attorney General talked about a court case, and I think it's important to stress that there was not an adjudication here. This is the Northtown Village case in which indeed a landlord paid a fine, a civil fine of $5,000. He was found to have added an administrative fee, and there were some other issues involved. He decided to pay rather than fight, as is common in these kinds of settlements. There's no adjudication here, but I think it's an indication of why the law ought to be clarified as to allowing a landlord to charge a fully disclosed reasonable fee along with the to cover the cost, just passing through the cost. Landlords clearly now can put it in the rent or even have an unspecified fee. There's no dispute about that. This caps the fee and requires full disclosure, and I think that's the value both to the tenants and to the landlord. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to wrap up, this is a very complex area, and these parties have all been working with each other, and I'm not unmindful of the fact that there is work remaining to be done on this bill, and so just want to state for the record that I appreciate the committee's support, and I look forward to working with all the parties to continue to resolve this issue, as this bill will wend its way through at least one more committee, likely two more, before it even reaches the General Register. Thank you.
All right. With that, Representative DeLaForest renews his motion that House File 680 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Commerce Committee. All those in favor?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd just like the record to reflect I recuse myself from the vote on this.
All right. Thank you. All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Nay.
No.
Motion prevails.
Division.
A division has been called for. All those in favor, please raise your hand. All right. And all those opposed? Five to five, the motion does not prevail. All right, the next bill on the agenda is House File 958, and the companion bill, Senate File 518, has passed the Senate and was actually sent to the consent calendar. So the House has given this bill its first reading. We will lay that House bill on the table, and we'll be acting on Senate File 518. Representative Ellison moves Senate File 518 be recommended to pass and sent to the consent calendar, Representative?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison, I have a feeling that we may not need any testimony on this bill. If you want to just give an introduction, and then if there are questions, we'll take them.
Mr. Chair, the bill does require very little, if any, explanation. It essentially is an efficiency bill and doesn't really change much other than the need for filing additional paperwork. What the bill basically does is it allows for committees not to have to file the campaign finance report with the local government unit. The report is still online. It's still with the state, and it does not have to be. And so we're simply, the county of Hennepin is simply asking that it not have to be filed in the additional place.
Any questions for Representative Ellison? Seeing no questions, Representative Ellison renews his motion that Senate File 518 be recommended to pass and placed on the consent calendar. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. The last bill on the... I'm sorry, Representative Emmer. House File 672, which is something that was passed out this morning of the Subcommittee on Data Privacy. Representative Emmer moves House File 672 be recommended to pass and sent to the Commerce Committee.
That's correct. That's my understanding. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House File 672 is a technical amendment to the Minnesota Data Practices Act. It was heard this morning in the Data Practices Subcommittee. Representative Holberg is the chief author of the bill. We heard testimony out this morning. It's basically cleaning up language. There was a problem in the act, the way the Division of Insurance Fraud Prevention was added into the language of those departments that it would apply to. The problem arose in that is a division of the Department of Commerce, and it created a problem for the Department of Commerce in terms of being able to share data within its division. That's been eliminated, and government entities has been replaced for subdivisions and trying to clean up the bill.
All right. Any questions for Representative Emmer?
Incidentally, it was passed with a recommendation for approval.
Any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor, Representative Emmer renews his motion that House File 672 be recommended to pass and sent to the Commerce Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Now House File 118, Representative Erdahl. Obviously, we're not going to have time to get through this whole bill, but what I'd like to do is get the testimony in for those who have been waiting for the whole meeting, and then maybe we can lay it over and finish it up at a later date. I will move House File 118 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. Is that correct, Representative Erdahl?
Or consent calendar.
Okay. Well, we'll stick with the General Register for now. Representative Erdahl.
You have the amendment, too?
We are getting it.
Yep.
Thank you. So is this an author's amendment?
Yes, it's author's okay. Amendment.
That's the AO5 amendment?
Yes.
I'll wait till everyone has it.
No.
No. Is it the 102?
This is the author's amendment. It's HO1181.
I'm sorry. The HO118A1 amendment. The only one that looks different from the other. The HO118A1 amendment. Oh, it's just coming around now.
Okay. This is the only one that I have.
Members, these were submitted timely, but because of some mix-up on Friday, we apologize. We did not get these to you.
Yep, mine is the A1.
Yours is the 118A1 amendment. Yes.
Okay.
And I will move that, the A1 amendment, in order to get the bill into the form that the author would like. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Now, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members, I prepared for this by watching two John Grisham movies over the weekend, so I'm ready to go. House File 118 is about personal responsibility and ensuring a marketplace of choice. We've all heard accounts of consumers blaming the food industry for their own actions. The ultimate was the actual filing of a lawsuit against a fast food restaurant chain because the claimant ate too much and became obese. It is true, as the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association has argued, that these cases have usually been thrown out by judges, but the aforementioned obesity case has been reinstated on appeal in New York and allowed to go forward. For several reasons, this bill is necessary. First of all, just filing these cases causes businesses thousands of dollars in unnecessary defense. Don't be fooled. The cost of these lawsuits will be passed on to the consumer. An already clogged judicial system will be further weighed down by baseless lawsuits. It's true that no such lawsuits have been filed yet in Minnesota, but it's only a matter of time. These attacks on the food industry are also attacks on jobs. The food service industry employs approximately 12 million people, making it the nation's largest private sector employer. While the focus of these lawsuits has been on the fast food industry, we cannot minimize the possible effect on Minnesota agriculture. Seeing a retailer or food processor ultimately is attacking the product produced by our farmers. Vilifying hamburgers ultimately hurts the beef producers. Many Minnesota companies process food for national fast food chains. Legitimate lawsuits can still proceed under this legislation. For example, an obesity-related claim can go forward if a company labels a food as containing zero calories when in fact it has hundreds of calories, causing someone to eat too much of it and gain weight. Also, House File 118 only applies to claims based on weight gain or obesity. Lawsuits involving tainted food could go forward. The goal of House File 118 is to ensure personal responsibility in a food court, not blaming others in a legal court because they excessively consume fast food. Obesity is a huge problem in America that we must address. It must be fought through knowledge and not through lawsuits. So, members, Mr. Chairman, we have a simple bill here that puts responsibility for weight gain on the consumer. Basically, you sum it up by saying, eat food, get fat, your fault.
Thank you, Representative. Was Joe Price here to testify on behalf of your bill? Why don't we have him come forward?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you. While he's doing that, I was just looking at the amendment that we just adopted, and perhaps this is what Representative Erdahl intended, but I believe actually on line 7, the second word should be proscribed rather than prescribed.
Sounds good to me.
Representative Erdahl?
Or isn't it?
I think, if I might jump in, I think it's talking about a material violation of an adulteration or misbranding requirement that is required. I think that's why it says prescribed. It's required by state or federal statute or rule. Did I read it wrong? And maybe Mr. Price or Representative Erdahl can comment on the amendment.
Representative Erdahl?
Because my understanding, I'm sorry, Representative Erdahl and Mr. Chairman, but my understanding is that it's specifically saying what Representative Erdahl testified to earlier, that this proposed law is not eliminating someone's right to bring a claim if, in fact, a food is mislabeled. And I think that line there is saying that the labeling required by some state or federal statute is violated. So prescribed, I think, would be the same as required. Maybe I'm wrong.
Representative Erdahl, maybe you can look at this since we're laying the bill over just to make sure.
Okay.
That's the word you're looking
at. Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Hilty. Mr. Price.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Joe Price. I'm an attorney at Fagery & Benson in Minneapolis, where I practice in the area of mass tort litigation and have so for the last 30-some years, having been involved in mass torts such as the Dalcon Shield IUD, breast implants, Ritalin childhood vaccines, etc. Based on my experience in handling mass tort cases, litigation is a poor way to make public policy, especially in the area of health and medicine. Obesity is an extremely complex medical and social issue. It's not a legal issue. It has physical components, it has genetic components, it has socioeconomic components, it has psychological components. Not everyone who eats a large amount gets fat. The diseases that obesity is claimed to be responsible for also are extremely complex. Diabetes, heart disease, stroke, hypertension, cancer. Certainly not everyone who's fat gets these diseases. Medical science today has many unanswered questions about what exactly causes these diseases. Is obesity caused by eating too many cheeseburgers or because kids don't have physical education? Or they watch TV or play with Game Boys instead of going out and playing soccer and tennis? Is obesity caused by adults eating too much pizza or sitting in front of a computer all day? Or living in a suburb where they don't have sidewalks and they have to get in their cars and drive instead of walking to the local grocery store? Science today cannot answer these kinds of questions, yet litigation asks lay juries to do so, a very inappropriate and inefficient system. The plaintiff's bar has claimed obesity food litigation will be their next tobacco. It's not like tobacco. The addiction issue is not an existent issue unless you believe that people don't need to eat at all, because we're all addicted to food in one fashion or another. Without it, we will die. The plaintiff's bar is rallying its troops. I've attended meetings of the Public Health Advocacy Institute, where over 100 lawyers met to study and plot strategy to sue the food industry. That meeting was in September of 2004, led by names like John Banzaff and Richard Daynard, who were instrumental in the tobacco litigation. These lawyers were eager to sue the food industry and just lining up for the opportunity. Their cases are supported by the Center for Science and the Public Interest, and they have assured the public that litigation is coming, both in the popular press such as the New York Times and USA Today, and in the scholarly legal journals like the Public Health Policy Journal and Tort Trial and Insurance Practice Law Journal, where an article just came out entitled Doctrinal Considerations for Fast Food Obesity Suits. In the headnote it says, the article offers an overview of obesity-related health problems and offers alternative legal theories under which such lawsuits may be brought in the future. The Pellman case, which was alluded to by Representative Erdahl, was just reversed by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, sent down for trial, even though that court had some questions about what the plaintiffs ate, how much they exercised, and their family's health history. These cases will have a big impact on Minnesota businesses. It's extremely expensive to defend mass tort litigation. In the breast implant litigation, we calculated that each case costs about $1 million to defend through trial. What the plaintiffs want to do is accumulate large numbers of cases and force settlements. Once they have enough numbers, at $1 million a case to try, it becomes too expensive, and they want us to just come up with some sort of global resolution. The cost to manufacturers are the direct cost of verdicts, judgments, punitive damages, settlements, legal fees, expert fees, trial consultant fees, public relations consultant fees, and insurance fees. The indirect costs are the disruption of the business, diversion of management, time and attention, employee morale, impact on stock, and shareholder litigation. Sanctions are usually ineffective in that the court sanctions that would be applied to these cases would not offset the costs. It's important to stop it now before it gets out of control. It is not a matter of legal responsibility, but rather a matter of personal responsibility of individuals and what they choose to eat or not eat. I'll take any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Price. Let me ask this question of both you and Mr. Carlson. If we lay this over and finish this hearing as well as take up the amendments first thing on Wednesday, would you both be able to be here?
Mr. Chairman, I have a deposition scheduled. What would the first thing be on Wednesday, time-wise?
What time do we start? 12:30.
At 12:30, there's a high probability I could be here. I have a deposition in the morning.
Mr. Carlson? We'll try to reschedule it so that the necessary people will be here. But I think at this time, I will lay the bill over. Representative Hilke.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I was just going to mention, didn't we get a notice that we have session on Wednesday at noon?
Okay.
So we might, I presume we're going to meet after session, yes. But
That
might not be promptly at 12:30.
We will reschedule this at a time where both of you can be here and whoever else needs to be here can be here. With that, we are adjourned. I'll lay this bill on the table and we are adjourned.